everywhere I live.
RoboZone coming up. He's got a long ways of...
Retro Gaming Radio 2011. Keep it retro.
Hello, folks. This is Shane R. Monroe, and you are listening to the February 2012 edition of Retro Gaming Radio. Welcome to the program. Big special welcome back to some of our old listeners. We've had a ton of new listeners since the show went back on the air, but now we're starting to see some of our old listeners from the classic days of Retro Gaming Radio show up. They've just now found the show. Some of these guys have been checking the site like every month to see if maybe we changed our minds and came back on the air. And once we did come back on, everyone totally freaked out and has been sending us email. We're going to read some of that to you, for you today here on the show. And let's see, what else do we have for you? Well, we got a packed show. We got almost an hour's worth of bits and bytes. We've got a review of a really cool piece of Chinese hardware. Alex J. Lopez is going to join me for that. We're going to tell you who the five winners are of the Cloanto-sponsored Commodore 64 Forever package. Both are great packages, folks. A little slip of the tongue there. I play a lot more Amiga than 64 these days. And, of course, we've got so much more. We're going to do some reader mail. We've got a review of the Neo Geo emulator for Android and iOS. Tons of stuff right here on Retro Gaming Radio. Stick around. As you know, last month we opened up the contest iHeart C64 in the celebration of the Commodore 64's 30th anniversary of 1982. And our challenge to you, the listeners, name off your favorite five Commodore 64 games. Tell us why they're your favorite. Email it in to us. And we got plenty of submissions. We've chosen the best five submissions out of the pack. And we're going to read the top two, the number one winner and the runner-up. We're going to read their complete submission, so that you have an opportunity to hear in their own words why they loved these Commodore 64 games. And, of course, we'll let you know who the runners-up are. So, Cloanto, the makers of Amiga Forever and Commodore 64 Forever packages, the best turnkey emulation solutions out there, especially for Commodore products, they were nice enough to divvy up the five copies. So all five of our winners will receive a copy of Commodore 64 Forever. So let's get on with it, and let's talk about the winners. Number one, the first winner, our primary winner, Vince Dickinson is our number one winner. His five games, along with their details, are as follows. Number one, Stuart Smith's Adventure Construction Set, 1984 from EA. See, he even put who they're from and the date. He spared no expense on writing these up. I loved RPGs, Abshai, Fantasy, Might and Magic, Ultima, Wizardry, Bard's Tale, the D&D Gold Box games, but this game let you make your own RPG with as much detail as you want. Create the graphics, quests, characters, dungeons, everything. It also had the unbelievable feature of finishing it for you. I spent countless hours on this wonderful, endless game. And absolutely, you know, we're huge fans of Adventure Construction Set. And I can't believe it's never been done again. I mean, I don't understand why they don't take almost that exact same thing and port it. People would love to do that now, especially with the autocomplete function, and you wouldn't have to wait 17 hours to do it. And that's the best part. Yeah, for those of you who remember what it was like to actually have it make you an adventure, it was time-consuming. If you only had one disk drive, stand by, because you were going to be busy. Next up on Vince's list, Impossible Mission from Epix, 1984. Truly a classic. The ominous voice, the sense of urgency, the variety of puzzles and traps. This game had a feeling like few games since. Perfect combination of action and puzzle solving, in addition to trademark amazing graphics and sound, makes it one of the best games of all time. Yeah, that pretty much sums it up. We love dropping that little guy in the hole and making him scream over and over again. I think we booted the game to hear the speech at the beginning. We ran him around, showed how cool it was to make him flip, and then we dropped him in the hole for about an hour at a time. So that works out really good. Vince's next game, Pool of Radiance, SSI, 1988. I was a huge D&D fan, and this game finally brought that rule set to the screen. The turn-based strategic combat was fantastic. The variety of dungeons, monsters, and characters was amazing. Even the backstory was cool and written better than 99% of modern RPGs. It was a little slow to play, but more than made up for it in scope and ambiance. I remember sitting in the basement playing Pool of Radiance, blasting Black Sabbath's first album, Good Times. Whenever I hear the album Black Sabbath now, I think about that moment in time, that and blowing up my party with a misdirected fireball spell. Been there, done that. Vince's number four is Winter Games, 1985, from Epics, of course. The whole game series was fun, but I played Winter Games the most. Something about nailing the 360s on skis and timing your strokes and speed skating, careening down the bobsled run, trying to maintain control. I think it was the focus on speed-based events that made me like this one a bit more than the others. Typical awesome Epics graphics and sound, and wonderful to play multiplayer. And to round out Vince's top five, Kane, Mastertronic, 1985. I was never a big fan of Westerns, didn't like the movies, but didn't like the games, with the exception of Kane. It was a multi-stage action game with excellent graphics, lots of variety, and a perfect level of challenge. You had a horse race, shooting birds with a bow and arrow, a gunfight in town, and another race chasing down a train. Great action and really fun and way beyond what you expect from a budget title. Well, Vince Dickinson is our number one winner. Congratulations. You'll get your copy of Commodore 64 Forever. I still want to say Amiga Forever, I know. So who came in number two? Who's our second place winner who also gets their email right online? Paul Chabotiak. I hope I said that right. You probably should send me a phonetic representation of your name if it's a hard one. Paul sent in his top five, and here they are. Number one, Gyrus. This arcade game port was amazing. How the programmers managed to get the SID chip to play Bach, Toccata, and Fugue in D minor and get just enough sound effects to add something extra was beyond belief. The stages played out like they did in the arcade game, and also keeping in the bonus chance stages made the game that much more authentic. Bubble Bobble comes in at number two for Paul, another arcade port that kept all the right elements from the arcade game. I played so many two-player games with both friends and cousins, and it was fun each time. There's something about sitting next to another living, breathing person that makes multiplayer gaming so much better. And I have to bring up the catchy background music that came, again, across amazingly well on the SID chip. Can't argue with you there. On anything, actually. Pitfall 2. This is the first action-adventure game that I was able to start and finish in one sitting. I know, not much of a claim nowadays, but back in the late 80s, this game was tough, for me at least. Making rough maps about how the levels were laid out are fond memories of this game. Remembering the tension of judging, will I make it under the bats and buzzards, and kicking myself when I got hit by a frog, and having to scroll all the way back to the last checkpoint. Number four, I like this one. This is one that doesn't get enough talk. Toy Bazaar. A little bit of an unknown game. I don't see it too often on Commodore 64 lists, but this was one of my most favorite games. I love the variety of ways to dispose of enemies, pop the balloons, jump over, jump on teeter-totter platforms. Love the fun bonus stages. And I love the bit of greed gaming in getting the air pumps turned off and seeing if you can get them all off for a nice bonus at the end of the level. This game is a huge favorite in my books, and oh yeah, the SID music is pretty awesome too. Paul's last game is a huge favorite of mine, Ford Apocalypse. What's amazing about this game was the collection of different action game elements that came together so perfect. It's a great flying platform game that is so unique, I don't think it's ever been done since. I spent long nights trying to perfectly navigate the caverns to rescue the prisoners. That tension of navigation sucked me in. And there you have Paul's five submissions, and he's our runner-up winner of the C64 Forever package. Congratulations. We also have, of course, three other folks that are going to get the package as well. I'll give you their top five games. I just won't go through the whole deal for each one. First up is Adrian Smith. His favorite games, Head Over Heels, Whizball, Archon, Mercenary, and Fantasy III, Wrath of Nicodemus. Next up, Mike Lorraine. He takes it with Ford Apocalypse, Jumpman, Jumpman Jr., Beachhead, and Dr. J versus Larry Bird one-on-one. And our last winner of the C64 Forever, provided by Cloanto, is Mark Fetcher. He scores in with Beachhead 2, Uridium, Whizball, Archon, and International Karate Plus, or IK Plus. Big congratulations to all the winners. Everybody who submitted, I'm sorry I couldn't give you all prizes, but I had to pick from the top five, and we had to make a decision at some point. Alex and I had a hard time coming up with the winners, but I think everyone did a great job, and congratulations to the winners. And we will be contacting you by email to get your prize all sent over to you. So thank you for participating, and this will not be the last of our contest. We've got plenty more in the pipeline that we're planning, so you keep listening to Retro Gaming Radio all year long for chances to win Great prizes.
Listen up, everybody. We have a very special announcement. March 17th, this is a Saturday, next month, March 17th, Saturday, at 9 p.m. Greenwich Mean Time, we are going to be meeting in a Google Hangout on Google Plus. This is going to be a live question and answer retro gaming radio event. Now, here's all you have to do to get in on this. Go to Google Plus. If you're not already logged in or registered at Google Plus, you're going to have to register or log in at Google Plus. There's no way I can get you in a Hangout unless you're registered with Google Plus. Get yourself registered. Add this person to your circles, one of your circles. It doesn't matter which one. Add Retro Gaming Radio Live. Retro Gaming Radio Live. Add that page to your circles. Once it's in your circles, we'll be able to invite you to the Hangout. At 8:45 p.m. Saturday, Greenwich Mean Time, Saturday, March 17th, we will send a Google Hangout invite to everybody that followed that circle. You'll then be able to come in, and this is both audio and visual. You don't have to have a video camera, but obviously you're going to have a microphone if you want to come in and hang out and ask questions. Alex J. Lopez will be running the show, and essentially what he's going to do is he's going to tell me who's next up. He's going to keep track of who's asked questions and who hasn't. I'm going to mute everybody, so I won't be able to hear anybody other than the person asking the question. I'll unmute the person. I'll have the question asked, and then I'll answer the question. We'll talk about it. I'll mute that person, and then Alex will tell me who's next on the agenda. Now, I'm hoping we can do this for about an hour, and we'll see what kind of turnout we have. Now, we've done this sort of thing in the past, and it's been absolutely fantastic. We've had some great guests and a great time. Some of the live stuff has been some of the best stuff we've ever done. So, again, here's the details. March 17th, Saturday, 9 p.m. Greenwich Mean Time. That's for my Arizona time, that'll be 2 p.m. So we're 7 hours behind here in Arizona. Your time zone's going to differ, so you'll need to look it up. Greenwich Mean Time, 9 p.m. That should get most of our UK listeners an opportunity to get in on it. Normally when we do this sort of thing, the UK people get screwed over because they're 7 hours ahead. So, get yourself on Google Plus. Just sign up. Log in. Once you're logged in, add to your circle Retro Gaming Radio Live. That's all you have to do to get an invite to the Hangout. 15 minutes prior to it, 8:45 p.m., the Hangout will open. You will see in your Google Plus stream that Shane R. Monroe is hanging out, and you'll be able to join the Hangout, and we will go through the whole Q&A thing. If you don't know what's going on, we're going to have plenty of opportunities to give you help and tutorials on the forum, on Twitter. We're going to tweet all this stuff out. It's good. The information is going to get to you. You don't want to miss this event. This is going to be like one of the greatest events ever, provided we get enough people to show up. And we're using Google Hangouts, one, because most of the people that are in my inner circle of friends and fans that are listening to the show already have a Google Plus account, plus the Google Hangouts don't require any special software. You don't have to have Skype or anything like that. All you need is a browser, and that's a very useful thing. So most people should be able to participate without having to go through a whole lot of trouble or install any special software or anything like that. So we're really excited to be able to use this cutting-edge, late-breaking technology to reunite our retro gaming radio fans. So, once again, put it on your calendar right now, March 17th, 9 p.m. Greenwich Mean Time, live retro gaming radio event. More details will follow.
We have an absolutely huge Bits and Bytes segment this month. Thanks, of course, to listeners just like you. Bits and Bytes is almost fully vetted by our listeners who send in their favorite articles and news stories with regards to classic and retro gaming. So, of course, we try to credit those folks, and myself and Alex do pull up a few tidbits ourselves throughout the month. But if you're interested in submitting a story for us, just send it over to bitsandbytes@retrogamingradio.com, and Bytes is spelled B-Y-T-E-S, by the way. And I'm sure that Alex will provide you with a link down there at the bottom if you're looking at the Plus TV player while you're watching the show here or listening to the show. So let's get on with it, because we really do have a lot to cover in Bits and Bytes this month. Good stuff, too. First up, let's see, Gary Adamson sent in a new version of R-Type. Now, R-Type, of course, is a very famous side-scroller shooter. A lot of fun, actually. But this time, it's for the Amstrad CPC, a machine I don't have a lot of familiarity with. but I absolutely love to see these sort of remakes happening for great classic games. Let's see. Vintage Games, nearly 25 years after its arcade release, Easter Egg is proud to announce to you that R-Type is finally back for your Amstrad Schneider CPC 128K. Yes, CPC like color personal computer, no more like crappy port compromise. Nice. So don't miss your last chance to blast off and strike the evil Baidu Empire. So, there you go. Like I said, I love seeing these sort of projects. And anytime anybody sees one of these, by all means, send it in. I love to look at that stuff. Here is a magazine that was sent in by Sega Ages, a pseudonym, of course, called Scroll. And I haven't had an opportunity to dig really through this magazine. It's been a very busy month. But they do provide some sample pages and whatnot. This is really nice. This is one of those magazines, those sort of homegrown magazines where you can get it in print or you can get a digital copy of it, whatever. Let's see. Let me give you what's the current edition here. This year, the Super NES turns 20 in America. It's certainly one of the best systems ever, but it might also be the most enduring one thus far. Lots of great games are released, variety, complexity, and many that are still great to play today. The proof is in the pudding when you look at titles like Chrono Trigger on the DS. Issue 1's cover story explores the history of Super NES and its struggle to endure, following by galleries of the best SNES games, both sung and unsung. Also in the issue, Frame 1, which is current events, Japan Desu? The Island of Misfit Hardware, Full Screen, Star Topics, Wait, Wait, Don't Talk to Me, and In Defense of Hydalide. It must be a game that I don't know how to pronounce. Anyway, they do have a photo gallery that you can go look at and see some of the photos that appear in the magazine. It's good. I mean, print is fastly becoming something of a Dark Ages sort of deal. I mean, we walked by, my friend Justin and I walked through Fry's Electronics, as we do at least once a week. And we walk right by a magazine stand, and every time I walk by it, it seems to be more and more of a less familiar thing. You know, I grew up in the 80s where everything was magazines, right? I spent hours and hours and hours typing stuff in for magazines and, you know, typing in MLX stuff. And for some reason, even though I am old school, you know, I'm 42 years old, and even now, magazines are starting to feel even foreign to me. Recently, I've been going through my own magazine collection, and I've been sending them off to that $1 scan place. Those of you who follow my exploits outside of Retro Gaming Radio know that I'm huge into this $1 scan place. Essentially, since we're on the topic of magazines anyway, essentially what this place will do is, for a couple of bucks for every 100 pages. I mean, there's a price breakdown, but for relatively cheap, you can take all of your archived magazines, you know, the things that are stacked up in your shed or your storage unit. You can take those out, mail them to them, and they will, you know, professionally cut the spine off and PDF them for you. Of course, the original material is destroyed, which for some people, that's, you know, that's blasphemous. But for myself, as long as I have the content, in this case, I don't need the original magazine. I'm good having my old Amiga formats, you know, all these sort of things. I'm happy to have those in a digital format because I'm much more likely to look at them. Right now, they're sitting out in the shed. But if they're on my tablet, I could sit down right now and look at them. So it's a matter of convenience. But I really do like to champion the cause of printed material. Just because I think it's sort of a dying art, you know, newspapers, magazines, and I don't think it's necessarily a good thing, and I'll tell you why. For example, all these magazines that I have in the shed, in my, you know, what's inside Shane's shed, I have tons of magazines. Yeah, most of them have already been cut apart and scanned by various collectors, which we're going to talk about later here in Bits and Bytes. But I've got magazines that no one's ever seen. You know, I've got old manuals. I've got these old paper copies. I've got the instruction manual for the Sixth Sense terminal software program for the Commodore 64. right? You're probably not going to find a digital copy of that anywhere. Maybe, but maybe not. Now, I could hoard that, and I could keep that locked up in my shed and never look at it, or I could contribute somehow back to preservation. Now, right now, all of these things exist in paper. Preservation is a matter of getting somebody to take their time and scan it and share. But what happens when there is no paper? What happens when every magazine is a PDF or a locked document? Something that only comes from iTunes or some other secure DRM source. These things are going to be more and more designed to be consumed and destroyed. And that's just human nature, right? The more effort, love, and cost you have to put into something, the less likely you are to chuck it, right? If you have to actually make and bind your own magazine, there's a value in that. There's something intrinsically valuable about putting together a magazine, printing it, and having people, you know, having pictures of people having it in their hands, things like that. And people are less likely just to consume and throw away. That's what we're into right now. We're into the consumption and throwaway. That's why things like Netflix and Hulu and these streaming services are so popular. People don't care. You know, I've got a closet full of, 4,000 movies because I'm a collector and I'm into preservation. I guarantee you at least 2/3 of the films that are in my library are not available on Netflix, they're not available on Hulu, and most of them are out of print. If it was only an electronic version that was available, let's say there's a film that's shot that's never committed to disc. Now, I know that sounds crazy, but if a film is never committed to disc, there's no physical medium, there will be no preservation. Because what's going to happen is that digital medium is going to get pushed aside, dropped offline, no longer supported, the rights will be lost, right? That happens on this Netflix and Hulu all the time. There's a show there, you've put it in your favorites or you've added it to your queue, you go back to watch it again and it's gone. They lost the rights to it, Sony pulled the plug on them, whatever. Without hard copy, without a physical medium, preservation is impossible. So that's why I really support this, things like the Scroll Magazine and people who are really willing to go out and do the dirty work of physical media. So, good job to you guys. Let's see, what do I got next here? Oh yes, this is one of my favorite stories, only because I'm less excited about it, because it's pretty much driven specifically towards Apple iOS development. And you probably know what the story is. Several people from old school gaming, such as Ed Logg, Ed Rodberg, and Seamus Blackley, who worked for Xbox, one of the co-creators of Xbox, are starting up a new mobile game company, that will be, unfortunately, driving and making content for iPhone and iPad. I say unfortunately because I don't have one, and I don't plan on getting one. I'm an Android guy, as most of you know, and there's no Apple products in the house, and I plan to keep it that way. Matter of personal preference. But let's see. Let me give you just a bit of this article. I'm sure it's going to be right there in the browser, but for those of you who are not watching the show on RGR Plus TV, shame on you. Seamus Blackley, the co-founder or co-creator of Xbox, passionately believes that gameplay will triumph in the game business. Well, duh. That is why he and his new startup are relying on a team of famous designers from Atari to make a series of games for Apple iPhone and iPad. The idea is he and his partner, Chief Executive Van Burnam, have dreamed up is to use the creators of the best arcade experience from the golden age of Atari in the 1970s and 80s to create games for the new arcade on iOS devices. Blackley says, we are looking at the new arcade at 99 cents on the iPhone as the new quarter. People are playing all these new devices and are finding the joy of arcade games, blah, blah, blah. You can keep going. Ed Rodberg, of course, Battlezone. Owen Rubin of Major Havoc and Space Duel fame. Rich Adam, creator of Gravatar, Missile Command. Ed Logg, Asteroid Centipede. Dennis Coble. I don't know this guy. Oh, yeah, Touch Me and Shooting Gallery. And Tim Skelly is the only non Atari veteran who worked for Cinematronics, of course, and created games like Rip Off. And Bruce Merritt, creator of Black Widow. Obviously, a dream team, right? That's pretty high up there. I mean, I've interviewed half those people, and they are, of course, incredibly important to the arcade industry. Now, here's what I would like to and not just because I'm not an Apple fan, even if this was, even if these guys were exclusively releasing to Android, I'd be telling you the same thing. There's a double-edged sword going on with this sort of thing. Namely, of course, is the fact that, first of all, these guys are brilliant. Every single one of the guys on that list is a friggin' genius. And yes, every single one of them contributed at least one top-notch, you know, top 100 video games of all time to our historic, you know, our history. But while these guys are geniuses at doing what the iOS really is, and Android for that matter, mobile devices in general are what I would call closed architecture systems. Now, iOS is completely closed, which is probably why they chose to do it. Android's a little more open-ended, right? You can get a variety of Android devices. You can get seriously underpowered Android devices, seriously overpowered Android devices. You got different tablets, different phones, different screen resolutions. That's that fragmentation that people like to talk about. But I think that's great. I think it's nice to have a choice with iOS and in general, you know, you've got the pad and the phone. And that's pretty much all you have to develop for. And they're very, very closed architectures. Now, these guys are geniuses with working with very closed, tight architectures, working with very low system resources, right? You don't have to have a Tegra 2 or essentially a desktop graphics card in one of these devices for these geniuses to irk out an amazing game. That's the good part of the equation. That's the side of the sword that has no blood on it. On the other side of the sword, of course, is these guys are used to being able to dictate hardware. And when I say hardware, I mean controls, right? Take a look at the games that these guys have made. Battlezone, custom hardware, right? Battlezone doesn't run with a joystick and two buttons. It runs with dual frickin' tank control style, and they had a heads up display and the whole bit. It was custom hardware. Major Havoc, right? That's a spinner. Or depending on which one you saw. I've seen it as a trackball. I've seen it as a spinner. Missile Command, same thing. Trackball. Asteroids, okay, that's more button-oriented. Centipede, trackball. Right? These guys are used to making games and being able to dictate the controls pattern behind it. They no longer have that ability. Unfortunately, this platform is not the same environment they're used to working in. Now, I believe these guys will make brilliant games. But I'm also saying that they're going to have an uphill battle, in my opinion. Because they can't say, oh, listen, I want to make a tank simulator. We're going to actually use a real tank controls. Well, no, you're going to use a touch screen. Well, I'm going to make this new game where you can move, you know, 180 degrees by rotating a trackball. No, you're going to make it using the touch screen. You know, I need a game that requires 17 buttons. You know, I'm going to do Defender on iOS. Well, Defender needs, okay, crap. Let's see, 6 buttons and is that 6? I'd have to go back and look. 6 buttons and an up-down control. Well, you're going to use the touchscreen, right? So, you know, it's no longer a matter of, well, we'll build the greatest game, we'll make the greatest control panel ever for it, and now we have this ultimate success. These guys are going to feel confined and in a box. And at some point in time, I'll go back and grab one of these guys because I know Ed Rotberg, I know Ed Log. I've interviewed both of them. I'm pretty sure I could get one of them to come back on the show and talk to us about that kind of development. Of course, because they work for the company, they don't want to undersell their products. I'm sure they'll paint a fairly rosy picture. But, you know, Ed Rotberg's a pretty straightforward guy. I think he'd tell us. And I'm sure they're going to want to promote this thing. So hopefully they look at Retro Gaming Radio as a viable option for that, despite the fact that we're not big Apple fans over here. So that's interesting. I mean, now remember, I said earlier, a couple episodes back, that Atari was moving to mobile gaming. And that's the smartest damn thing they can do. I think mobile gaming is where Atari needs to be because of their working in that closed environment, low resources. It requires a different type of programmer to make superior games in the mobile marketplace. And there's not a lot of them. I don't care how popular Angry Birds and Cut the Rope and all of these games are. They're really just gaming bites. They're little bits of gaming. If you want true epic gaming, real gaming, you have to have the controls and you have to have developers that are cognizant of the requirements and the restrictions and working in that area. You know, Skyworks, David Crane, Gary Kitchen, they went over to do Skyworks, and Skyworks is a web-based company. So they're used to, they're making games for the web. And in doing that, they're, again, they're using tight engines like, you know, Flash or Shockwave, Director, these sort of things. And they work very well in that environment. They don't work well in the environment. It's like, well, here, let's throw some more memory at it. Let's throw some more of this at it, whatever. They are used to working in that environment. So I think that they'll make great games. But I do believe, though, that it's going to be a challenge trying to get these old school arcade developers to deal with a touchscreen only control system. I really do. Let's see. Next up. Let's see. That was also by Sega Ages that sent that in, by the way. I mean, a couple of different people sent it in, but they sent it in first. Ronald Smith is a regular contributor to Retro Gaming Radio's Bits and Bytes segment, and this month he sent us over something pretty cool. This is a t-shirt featuring Donkey Tron. Yes, that's right, Tron. Donkey Tron is a Tron version of Donkey Kong featuring Tron graphics. And, of course, if you're looking at the Plus TV player, you're going to see it in all of its glory while we're listening. So that's great stuff. Anyway, so I've got to have one of these t-shirts. I'm going to have to order one because, first of all, it's Donkey Kong with Tron. I mean, what else do you need, right? It's fantastic. It's got little light cycles instead of barrels. It's got... Anyway, you can check it out. Check it out. It's good stuff. I don't know how much I really need to talk about it. It's fantastic, and thanks, Ronald, for sending that in. It's fantastic. Dana Eiler, big fan of the show. He's been a fan of the show for a long, long time. He knows I'm a big fan of these sort of game conversions. We've got a couple of these this month. He sends over Scorpion.nz, website that is hosting here, Yo-Yo Games website, where the games are hosted. That's what I was looking for. Anyway, he's done two remakes of games, the game Mousetrap and Venture. Mousetrap, and these are, I believe, conversions of the ColecoVision versions. Okay, so they're not arcade versions. I grabbed both of them, and I did take a look at them. And, you know, they're what you would expect them to be. They're Mousetrap and Venture. They essentially look, act, and sound exactly the same as the ColecoVision version. So that's pretty cool. I would like to have seen them maybe enhance it a little bit, maybe do something, you know, not different, but kind of enhanced, you know, enhanced sound, enhanced graphics. I'm okay with that. Yeah, so Venture, of course, is, they're both Exidy games, and I think I actually have, last time I checked, I had the world record for the ColecoVision version of Venture. The problem with the Coleco version of Venture is that once you get to a certain level, it's pretty much the same difficulty over and over again, so you play until you're bored, and I think I played like 4 hours and I got bored. But anyway, so if you're a big fan of Exidy games, especially the ColecoVision versions of Mousetrap and Venture, you can reach over there and grab them. So, again, free of charge, gotta love that, and anything that's supporting classic gaming like that, I'm definitely down with. So thank you for that. Okay, now here we go. There's a place called Vizzed, V-I-Z-Z-E-D, Vizzed.com, and again, watching the TV version, you're gonna see it. Vizzed Retro Game Room. This is where you can play games, pretty much any possible game you can imagine, online for free in your browser. And when I say every game, I pretty much mean every game. Here are some of the systems that they have, that they support. Game Gear, Super Nintendo, Sega Master System, Game Boy Advance, Nintendo Turbo Graphics, Nintendo 64, Game Boy Color, Apple II, Sega Genesis, Game Boy, Atari 2600, Sega 3D, Commodore 64, MSX, and I think there's a few more in there. Yeah, so those are the systems supported. So now, you know I'm a huge Commodore 64 fan, so I'll check Commodore 64, right? This is, they got a search page because there's just that much stuff going on. I'll check, and I'll hit search, and I'll see if I can get a list of what they've got. I'll just give you an example. Let's see. Looks like, okay, so here's just a handful of them. So there's the Bad Super Mario Brothers port, Monty on the Run, Star Wars, Ghostbusters, Great Gianna Sisters, Galaga, Vamir, Mario Brothers 2, which is another, you know, homebrew thing, Solomon's Key, Lode Runner, Tron Light Cycles. There's 446 games, right? Whizball. Let me see if they've got something like Ford Apocalypse. That's for me. So let me type this in here, Ford Apocalypse. And sure enough, there it is. Let me see. Well, maybe there's not. Where'd it go? Yep, there it is, Fort Apocalypse. So you click on the game, and it brings you up, you know, a little information about it, and you click play game, and it opens up a new window, and it runs a Java emulator that lets you play the game inside of a screen. All right, now I know what you're thinking. How is this legally possible? Well, first of all, the site's still up, and it's probably not because they haven't been discovered. But there are, essentially, here's how it works. Let me see if I can give you, let's see, here we go. Let's see. VISD was founded and created by David, oh great, here's a name for you. Achampak? Achampak? Sorry if I just totally butchered that. And it's currently the only developer of the site. Most of the features, ideas, and graphics are developed by him. The board forum is made by Custom Software. Who cares about that? Blah, 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 blah. Credit some developers for emulation, blah, blah, blah. Okay, so general disclaimer. All the games in Retro Game Room are no longer being sold or distributed. Assume they are all really a form of abandonware. Well, that doesn't hold any legal weight, right? VISD owns a physical copy of many of the digital copies in the game room, especially potential copyright violators. All right? When playing the games on VISD, you are renting a digital copy of each game and will not have the ability to download the game to your machine. Well, that's going to make people a little happier, right? VISD does not sell any software, which VISD does not fully own, or does VISD condone that sort of act. VISD will remove any copyright violations upon request and proof that the game is in violation. Of course, that's standard. All the games are free to play, although they cost VISD site currency. VISD is also free and easy to earn. This helps reduce the cost of bandwidth. Your save file of each game will be available as long as VISD is available or until you've deleted or overwrote it. Community free, does allow donations, blah, blah, blah. If you have any legality questions, please PM me here, blah, blah, blah. Okay, so this is not exactly a new concept. We've seen this before, where essentially, it comes down to how many rights do you actually have when you own a copy of a game, right? This is why things like this and the questions that this raises are exactly why they don't want us to have physical copies of games, right? This is why they want to kill the used game market. They want to move everything to server-side products, because when you have a physical product in your hand, you have rights. You have rights to that product. Now, you don't have the rights to do certain things on it. You're given a limited license, of course. But if I have a Ms. Pac-Man cartridge for the Sega Genesis, I can do stuff with that cartridge. I can play it. I can loan it to my friend, right? I can go right next door and say, hey, you want Ms. Pac-Man for Sega Genesis? Here, go play it. And he plays it. When he's done with it, he gives it back to me. I can sell it. I can go to eBay right now and put that right online and make $5, whatever it's worth. Now, this guy says, listen, I've got a copy of the game. I own the game. So instead of me mailing it to you and letting you play it, costing us both a lot of money and a lot of time, I'm going to allow you to lock it down and play it online legally through an emulator. That's pretty cool. I mean, the concept is solid. Now, whether or not, if that went to court, he could actually have something to go on. Now, I'm assuming that this is pretty much the same system that OnLive uses, right? Because when you're playing Assassin's Creed on OnLive, you're not playing a real copy of the game. You're playing a license of the game. So they have, you know, 200 licenses or whatever for, you know, Assassin's Creed. And when you're playing it, it locks one of them out. And now there's 199 licenses left for somebody else to jump in and play. So it's not that much different. But in the case of OnLive, everybody gets to make money. OnLive makes money, the publishers make money, everybody makes money, you know, top to bottom. Whereas in this case, you know, the only person that's really making any bank here is the guy that's, you know, running this site and selling ads on it, right? I mean, that's, you know, he's providing a service. I could put up a website that says, borrow games from me. I could put ads all over the thing and say, listen, here's my list of games. You tell me what you like. I'll charge you $5 and I will mail it to you in a mailer that has a return receipt, you know, return thing in it, just like Gamefly, just like Netflix, and you'll send it back to me. Now, am I acting illegally? I don't think so. I own the license to the game. I can do with that license what I want. So this is an interesting sort of thing that we're going to have to watch in the future to see just how far, because why wouldn't Nintendo jump in on something like this? If Nintendo, I mean, Nintendo could do this in like 2 seconds. They could put their entire catalog of first-party games. Now, they're milking their system and running it through the eShop and the WiiWare stuff. So they're making money through it a different way. But they could do the exact same thing. So could the people who own all this copyright stuff. You know, the Activisions, the Broderbunds, the Epics. All of these people could get together and do just this. Which is kind of like what that gaming device is we talked about last month or the month before. Was trying to do. They're trying to unite everybody. So anyway, if you're dying to play some of the games that you hear talked about on the show, and you don't want to set up an emulator and go through all that stuff, well, now you have an option, Vizd. So, pretty interesting. Again, I'd like to see how this plays out legally if you ever got pulled into court over it. Next up, this is actually an older article, but since I just got to see one of these things personally, I wanted to talk about it. Pac-Man Battle Royale now is the first four-player competitive Pac-Man arcade game. Now, if you remember back in the old days, and I can't even begin to tell you just which episode I talked about this on, but we talked about this. There's a game called Footman on the Amiga where you played competitive Pac-Man. So this isn't anything new, but let's talk about this. The original Pac-Man game concept is beginning in a cannibalistic twist. Eliminate your opponents by eating them, and the last Pac-Man standing wins the round. When players eat a power pellet, they power up, doubling in size and increasing in speed. Once powered up, they are now able to eat non-powered up blue players and ghosts. Players of the same size simply bounce off of each other. Players can also be eliminated by running into ghosts if there aren't any powered up players. Eating a piece of fruit or all the pellets resets the maze with a fresh new set of power pellets. At the end of the game, statistics are displayed, and each player gets, you know, most one rounds, most eight Pac-Mans, etc. And you can download, apparently off iTunes, a free demo round on iOS. Again, missing my Android device, so screw you guys. No, seriously. So I got a chance to actually see this but not play it. It's based off the same engine that Pac-Man Championship Edition uses. They just threw in the battle portion of it. But it looks really neat, and unfortunately we were sort of promised in the beginning of this whole thing that there would be a home version, there'd be a console version or whatever, but it sounds like it is no longer going that way and it's going to be exclusive to arcades, which is fine. I mean, I'm glad that there's a reason to go to arcades now. This would definitely be one of them, but at the same time, you know, I'm not going to get down to that arcade very often, so unfortunately I won't have time to actually get good at it, but it'll be interesting to see. I'm sure when the money runs out at the arcade, they'll turn around and release it for home. That's just the way it works. That was sent in by Jonathan Doyon. I should have people send me phonetic spellings of their names just so I get it right. I feel horrible when I don't get people's names right. Next up is an article on Glitterberry.com called Konami, the Nintendo Era. And this is really good. This talks about... they got a little synopsis here. The following discussion between two early Konami programmers took place in 2003. It was retrieved from Game Staff List Association Japan, a Japanese website that, among other things, aims to summarize, transcribe, and categorize interviews with video game developers. It was a commission and originally posted on Silicon Era. All right. So anyway, this has a couple of different people. Let's see. Famous for creating Konami Code. He joined Konami in 83, blah, blah, blah. Anyway, so you can go and read this. It's really, really interesting what these guys, you know, talking about how they built the first of their games as well as the programming, coin-operated games. They got tons of stuff in here. It's really, really interesting. It talks about Gradius, a bunch of other games, you know, Track and Field. So it's worth looking at, especially if you're a fan of the interviews. Let's see. They talk about like the secret stuff that developers put in to help them test their games, you know, to give themselves infinite lives or some sort of trainer that they can help themselves through their game. It's very cool. I would check that out. That was sent in by one of us, either myself or Alex. Very cool. Worth your time to read that, though. Really neat. All right, what's up next here? We got the glitterberry out of the way. By the way, if you hear incessant little noises behind me, I'm tired of stopping and starting my recordings over again. You're hearing my stupid ferrets running around in their cage. And unfortunately, their cage is huge, or I would move them out of the way. Next up, we're getting a reboot of a very, very famous game. Now, here's the fun part about this game. The game is pronounced universally as Karateka. Now, as you all know, I pronounce it Karateka. Why do I pronounce it that way when it's obviously wrong? And we've been smacked down by Jordan Mechner and everybody else about how to actually pronounce the game. Well, Atari put out a commercial for this game, and they called it Karateka. Now, listen, if you don't care enough to make sure your television frickin' how much did that television commercial spot cost? It had to have costed a fortune, right? So you couldn't get the guy to say the name right? So I'm thinking there's something afoot here, and I'm going to call it Karateka as long as I want to, so screw everybody else. Anyway, doesn't matter, though. Whatever you call it, it's still a fantastic game. It's by the guy, Jordan Mechner, of course, is known from Prince of Persia fame. It started off as an Apple II game, and you can tell if you look at the graphics. Of course, I played it on the Commodore 64, and it is a fighting martial arts sort of adventure game where you work your way through to save a chick. Of course, isn't it always about saving a chick? It's got to be because we didn't get laid enough as kids, right? I mean, it's got to be every guy's goal is to save the girl, right? Anytime we program these games, save the princess, save the girl, rescue the girl, get this. It's got to be because we were, you know, isolated in school or something. I don't know. But anyway, so we're going to get a new version of it. And there's an interview here that talks about why they're going to do the new one, all that sort of thing. And it's got some good backstory about the game. And there was something I was not thrilled about. It's probably what platforms it's coming out for. Oh, it's coming out on Xbox Live and PlayStation Network. So I would have rather have seen a game like this get remade for, say, a handheld device. Preferably like the Nintendo 3DS. That'd be great. I would love this game. Look at the game. I want you to look at the screen, if you can, if you're not listening in your car or something, if you're watching the TV version. I want you to look at the screen and the videos of the game and tell me that that wouldn't totally kick ass as a 3D title. The 3D space would be fantastic. So anyway, so they're going to revisit that. We're going to get that. I don't know when they said it was going to come out, but it's really an interesting article about how he made it, what the influence was behind it, etc. So it's definitely worth looking at, especially if you're a big fan of the game. And let's see. That was sent in by Alex, by the way. Earlier, I talked to you guys about preservation being huge, especially magazines. Anybody who grew up in the old Commodore era, the old Atari era, the old IBM PC era, magazines were how you got information. There was no internet. There were BBSs maybe, a little Quantum Link maybe, but there really wasn't a really excellent source of information. Well, magazines is how you got that information. And there were magazines for every platform, sometimes 5, 6, 7 magazines. Sometimes there were magazines specifically for a subculture of the platform, like on the Amiga, right? There were a couple of different types of Amiga users. There were the casual home gaming Amiga users, and then there were these diehard professionals, video toaster, video titling, Genlock, doing video production work with Amigas. And that's a totally different market. You know, they don't want to read Amiga format and see what the latest game from Team 17 is. They could care less. So they had video toaster user. They had, professional computer graphics magazines, right? So they had, I mean, there was such a huge market for magazines at that point in time. And, of course, most of my nostalgia comes from getting my Compute Gazette every month in the mail, my Run magazine in the mail, looking through the ads, seeing what the latest hardware was and the latest stuff, seeing if the price dropped on the next machine that you wanted so that maybe you could actually get one. So I went out to my shed not too long ago, and I saw this huge stack of magazines. I said to myself, man, I've got to get these out of here. I mean, what's going to happen? This thing's going to catch on fire someday. It's going to burn to the ground. I'm going to lose all of these things. And I'd recently found out about this $1 scan place, and we'll make sure you get a link to it. The $1 scan lets you send in magazines, books, and they will cut them up, and they will send them through a scanner, and they'll given back to you as PDFs. Unprotected, no DRM, no crap PDFs. That's perfect, right? That's what I need to do. I need these magazines out of my shed, and I need them committed to a digital thing, not DRM'd, not, you know, iTunes, none of that crap. These things need to be something I can put on a disc, stick in a drawer, and be able to get to anytime I feel like it. Regardless of whether somebody lost the rights to this, or somebody's pissed off about this IP, or the magazine contains an article that so-and-so doesn't like, so they clip that out of the magazine and put just the partial magazine online. No, no, no. I wanted these things preserved. Well, I started looking around, and I said to myself, it's pointless for me to send in and pay to have these things scanned if someone's already done them. So I started looking around to see, and there's various little projects kicking around of people that have scanned magazines. Well, here's two Compute Gazettes, and here's a Compute, and here's an Amiga format, here's an Amiga World, here's, you know, five runs. But in reality, what you really need is something a little more comprehensive, right? I need something that I can bring up a list. Okay, this has been scanned, this has been scanned, this has been scanned. And I just chuck these magazines in the trash. If they've been scanned, I'm good. So I ran across something called DLH's Commodore Archive. This guy has been, I'm assuming it's a couple of different people, but it looks like it's pretty much one guy. And he's been doing this. Let me see if the copyright gives me any indication how long he's been at it. Nah, it doesn't say. He's been doing this for a while. This guy has got pretty much everything you could ever want. Now, he doesn't have complete collections of everything, but he's got complete collections of a lot of things. And in that, with that respect, I was able to find and eliminate almost all of the magazines that I had stashed for Amiga and Commodore in my shed. Now, here's the cool thing. You can download all of these things. You can download them one at a time, two at a time, whatever. Or you could be a scumbag and site rip the site. But he's offering a DVD set, literally for $35-$40. And it's a complete set of all of these magazines. Let me see here. Let's see if I can get this up. Let's see. It's something like, 35, 18, so it's like, what, 50, 54 discs? 54 DVDs packed full of magazines, instruction manuals, periodicals, newsletters, everything that he could collect. And some of these are actually fully complete in terms of scope. So for 25 and 15, so what's that, 35, 40 bucks. For 40 bucks, I was able to get a complete set, 50-something discs of Commodore magazines. Now, you're always kind of hesitant ordering online, right? Especially, you know, like, you know, only U.S. shipping. The guy throws in shipping, right? Et cetera, et cetera. So he's got these available. I made my purchase on PayPal. Within 24 hours, he wrote me back and said, I got them. I'm packaging them up right now. Please let me know when they get there. And they came to me within a couple of days, and poof, I had them. And I'm telling you, I literally just fell into a trance for hours pouring through these discs. Now, my project is to upscale these guys and take all the DVDs and move them to Blu-ray discs, Blu-ray ROM discs, because, you know, I don't want to hold 54 discs. I'm fine doing it, but if I can take 54 discs and cut it down to 12 discs, that makes more sense to me, right? So that's what my personal project is, and while I'm doing it, I'm getting to go back and look at all this stuff. So the DLH Commodore Archive, listen, I don't think this guy can be making a penny on these things. He's doing it out of the goodness of his heart. So I would go over to the site, at least drop him a thank you note, take a look at some of these old magazines and things like that, and maybe pick yourself up a set. I'm hoping he's making some money. I'm tempted to throw him another 20 or 30 bucks, because after the cost of the shipping and all the discs and the case, you know, he puts them in little sheets, even in bulk, that sort of thing is going to add up. So I'm hoping he's making a couple bucks off of it, because he definitely deserves it. Excellent. Excellent, excellent, excellent. Next up, let's talk about, okay, let's talk about Digital Dan. Now, Digital Dan is one of those great urban myths, I guess, if you will, when it comes to Commodore 64 and me. Digital Dan, Let me give you a little back history. I know I've talked about it before. I'm sorry, but we have a lot of new listeners, and I want to make sure nobody gets completely lost. Back in the days of Quantum Link, which is a Commodore 64, it essentially was AOL before AOL turned into what AOL became. Before AOL came along, there was a company making something called Quantum Link. And Quantum Link was a graphical, beautiful interface to online communications. It was actually a really neat service. It was like $3.60 an hour, which wasn't bad. For all the stuff that they offered, you can download files, you could do real-time chats, they had online games. It was amazing for what it was way back when. Anyway, one of the things that I did off Quantum Link was download music files. Now, most of the things that I downloaded were SID player things, which were really, really small. They took up a very little space, and they were some brilliant composers making music on the Commodore 64. Well, SID player is one thing. I ran across something called a digital DAN file. And what, it was huge. It was like the full size of a disc. I mean, a full Commodore 64 disc, which was, let me see if I can do the math here, 160K, something like that. Seems like nothing now, but back then it was huge. And they had a whole section of these music files. And they were things like Laura Branigan's Self Control, Final Countdown from Europe, Black Betty. What were some of the other ones I saw? There were tons of them. They were huge. And so I downloaded one, and I believe it was Self Control. So I was a big Laura Branigan fan. Anyway, so it took like 2 hours to download. So you paid like $8 for this thing. And so it came down, and then you ran it, and it popped up with this, like, no kind of screen at all. It just came up with a screen that had, like, copper bars along, you know, the copper effect bars. And it played back, like, 8 seconds of Laura Branigan's Self Control. But it was digitized. I mean, this was, you gotta understand, this is like 1982 or something, right? It was 6 seconds of 8-bit digitized audio of Laura Branigan. And I just sat there with my mouth hanging open. It was the most amazing thing. I mean, we'd had a couple of games by then that had a little bit of digital speech in it, like Beachhead 2 and, you know, Epic's Impossible Mission. But nothing like this. This was like, and so I played it over and over and over again. And between each time it would play, it would stop on a screen that said made with Digital DAN. And I was like, what the hell's Digital DAN? You know, we didn't have an internet or Wikipedia back then. So we had to do, you know, our best we could. I hit all my local magazines. I did everything I could to find out more about this product. Nothing. Nothing, nothing, nothing. Well, I went back up and blew tons more of my money and downloaded more and more of them. I had probably 5 or 10 of them at the time. And they were huge. They were like a full disc for just 1 6-second piece of audio. But every single time I was amazed that my Commodore 64 was doing this. It blew me away. Well, Digital DAN has always been something, just a mystery. What the hell is Digital DAN? Where did it come from? What is it? You know, obviously it's an audio sampler, but what is where do you get it? How do you get it? You know, where did it come from? How are they making this amazing sounding music off of an 8-bit computer? Blah, blah, blah. So I started a lifelong search for Digital DAN. Well, honestly, there was just nothing. In fact, if you actually went and tried to find Digital DAN now on the internet using every powerful search engine tool that we have, you'll probably find my posts asking people, do you know anything about Digital DAN? That's the only way you find it. It's the same thing as last month in The Entertainer, right? It was a very small group of people, you know, respectively speaking back then. You know, there were hundreds of thousands of people on Quantum Link, but now there's like, you know, 500 million people on the internet. So it's a different market, okay? So I've been looking and looking, and every few years I'll go out and I'll search again. Maybe somebody's posted something. Maybe there's a picture of the hardware. Maybe there's something out there. Nothing. Every single year, every single time I look, nothing, 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 nothing. There's no Digital DAN. So recently, on Lemon 64, which is a great website, by the way, Lemon 64 for all your Commodore 64 gaming needs, and that was not a paid plug. I found a message board and I posted something. I found somebody talking about music and about, you know, odd pieces of music, and I posted something about The Entertainer. And as you know, last month I was finally reunited with this lost piece of music for the Commodore 64. Well, I decided, well, let's talk, see if I can find something about Digital Dan. I mean, what the heck? These guys came through with this other thing. Maybe I'll get lucky. So somebody wrote back, somebody posted something right afterwards and said, hey, yeah, what about Digital Dan? Does anybody remember this? Blah, blah, blah. I'm like, whoa, there we go, that's it. So I wrote this guy a PM, and this guy, you know, he had written it a couple of years ago, so God only knows if the guy was still around. He used the handle Ice Pick, which is fantastic, right? That's the Commodore 64 cracking cartridge that I talk so fondly about. Anyway, his name was Ice Pick, which is great. So I wrote on this little, I'm going to read you these emails, because I'm too lazy to cut them out and put them in a page so you can look at them on the TV viewer. I wrote him, I said, hey there, man, I've been looking for someone like you for a long time. I run a podcast called Retro Gaming Radio, been around since 1998, long time show, blah, blah, blah. Digital Dan is the stuff of legend. I've been trying to find the files created with it that were uploaded to Quantum Link ages ago. The Final Countdown, Self Control, and a few others were done. For years, I almost convinced myself that I made it up, since information on Digital Dan is scarce. Do you still have any of the files created with it? I'd love anything you could provide. You mentioned even having the program disc. Thanks so much for taking the time to read and respond. By the way, I love my Ice Pick. Last show, I did a 30-year retrospective, and my fondest memories, of course, Ice Pick made the list, blah, blah, blah. Ice Pick writes back and says, Digital Dan was an amazing novelty when I first got it. I was flabbergasted the first time I heard digital music coming out of my C64. The novelty wore off after you filled several diskettes with 6-second clips of your favorite songs. Even BBS has started refusing them, but there was always Q-Link. I'm surprised the info on Digital Dan is practically non-existent. The music files it produced were, for a brief time, very popular on BBS's and Quantum Link. I downloaded many that were made by various people, so at least a few units were sold. When I had mine, I opened the case, but it was completely covered in dark epoxy, so you couldn't make out any components. Anyway, I had to dig out my old Pentium 3 out of storage so I could transfer the diskettes I have to D64 images via XA1541. You can download the digital songs, 7 discs, and the Digital Dan program disc from here. By the way, Ice Pick was my first, but not my favorite. That would be the Super Snapshot 5, which was another cracking cartridge. It's funny, everyone has their favorite. Some people liked Final Cartridge. I liked Action Replay. So I wrote back, you know, thank you so much for getting back to me. As a historian of the Commodore 64, getting this was huge to me. I really appreciate your effort in pulling out the old hardware and making the images for me. Yet it's amazing that 16 seconds of music could elicit that sort of response. I remember it taking hours to get one down from Q-Link and playing Laura Branigan's Self Control over and over again. I would love any and all history you have on the product. Where did you buy it? What did it cost? Do we know who Dan was? Anything of interest you can remember. I popped in a couple of discs in the program disc. I remember the speech intro to the program. I must have at one time run down the program itself, even though I never found the hardware. Remarkable. Again, thanks so much. How would you like to be credited on the show? By the way, I was an Action Replay guy. He writes back, you currently have everything I have. I no longer have my Digital Dan or any C64 hardware except for a couple of 1541 drives. I don't remember where or precisely when I got it. More than likely it was from an ad I saw in Computes Gazette, since I had a subscription and purchased the majority of my C64 gear that way. It may have even been purchased from a BBS ad, since I purchased some used Sega Genesis cartridges that way. I can't honestly remember, since I only used it for a few months to upload music so I could earn massive amounts of download credits on BBSs. Eventually, BBSs would no longer accept these, since they had so many and they took up a lot of disk space. That's about the time I, too, lost interest in Digital Dan, loaned it out, and forgot about it. I recently downloaded all Compute Gazette discs from Usenet and looked at a few issues to see if I could find anything, but no luck. I'll keep looking and let you know if I find anything. No need to credit me for anything. It's all in the name of preservation. What a nice guy, right? Anyway, so I got a hold of the program disc, and I started digging through it. A lot of times, as you know, hackers and people of that nature like to throw in a little something, right? They throw in stuff, you know, hidden messages and that sort of thing. And there may be more hidden. I didn't get a chance to look for that long. But I did find out that the company credited for making this device was someplace called Digital Creations. Now, interestingly enough, if you look up Digital Creations, you'll find that they were responsible for some media devices on the Amiga. So it definitely stands to reason that these guys may have been affiliated with it. The one thing I could find, which is on an Amiga resource page, was the company was started in 1986. Digital Creations wrote and marketed the application software for all desktop video products of a company called Progressive Image Technology, another big popular company. Besides that, they developed three video paint systems, including Brilliance, which, by the way, you were either a Deluxe Paint guy or a Brilliance guy. Very few people were both. I was a Brilliance guy. And wrote three games for Electronic Arts. Through the years, the company marketed video hardware like the DC TV and Genlox under its own name. By 1992, they had 12 employees. Mid of 1994, Digital Creations merged with Progressive Image Technology and a group of eight former senior staffs of NewTek, who left that company in 1994. The new company was called Play Inc., which it should sound familiar to you, and they started a business marketing desktop video for PC compatibles. Now, I actually have something from Play Inc. It's called the Snappy, and it was a video digitizer for a PC. So this is the history. Now, just imagine imagine a world where there's none of this. I mean, I keep chanting and crying about this disposable ecosystem that we're in, but, you know, in 30 years, maybe 25 years, in 25 years, is my kid going to go back and want to find out information about something that he used, you know, or he was interested in as a 12-year-old? Probably not, right? That just blows me away that that's even possible. Now, of interest also, the staff was John, Dennis, and Bill. No Dan's in there, but it could very well have been an acronym. You know, Dennis could have been one guy that had something to do with it. So who knows what Digital Dan really means? Where does the Dan come from? But I'm happy to know that it wasn't my imagination, and I do have copies of these files, which I will post somewhere so you guys can run it in an emulator, like the great Cloanto C64 Forever package plays them just fine. So this is sort of it's not arresting yet. I don't have enough information on Digital Dan to put it to rest. I want to know more. So if any of my listeners know more, of course, clue me in. But to do this sort of historical research to me is fascinating, to be able to watch these roots and see where the people that were doing things back then, where they are now, what they're doing now, and trace them back like that. To me, this is a fascinating deal, and it saddens me more and more the more I think about the concept that this sort of mentality or this sort of behavior just isn't going to continue forward, you know. Even with my kids, I'm going to do my best, but, you know, they live in a disposable society, so I don't know. But anyway, so Digital Dan, again, thanks to Icepick for hooking us up with that. That really, it makes a difference. And now that I have a copy of the software, I can dig more through the source code and find out more information. I do know that he used one of the old protection schemes for BASIC, where it basically puts a breakable REM statement at the end of each line, so you can't list the program code without removing all the REMs. I actually had a program that would remove all of those REMs so that you could actually look at the code. And someday if I'm really bored, I'll do that. Anyway, the copyright date from Digital Creations is 1986. So if that helps anybody out in my historical record, that's what the software says when it said it was made. So there you go. Digital Dan, you know. Hey, would you guys settle down over there? My goodness, you know, this is the problem. How do I record a show when I have animals like this just making noise left and right? I know Bits and Bytes is running a little bit long here, but I've only got a couple more stories to go through, and I want to get to all of them. You may remember a couple of interesting point-and-click adventures like Grim Fandango and Day of the Tentacle and Full Throttle. These were created by an industry veteran by the name of Tim Schafer, and he started up a new company called Double Fine Productions. And they are looking to recreate and create a new point-and-click adventure. Now, is there a market still for point-and-click? I really believe there is. Unfortunately, things like Zack and Wiki on the Wii, which was an amazing point-and-click adventure, didn't get really any love at all. So it'll be interesting to see how this works out. They were looking more interesting, I think, than even the story. Which is great. I mean, I want you to go and check out Double Fine Productions, and I want you to see what these guys are doing, because they're going to be developing for the PC, the Mac, Linux, iOS, and Android. So that's great. You're going to be able to get DRM-free versions as well. So these guys have my support. But this is a very new system, and I want to talk about it just a little bit because I think that there's a future for this, obviously. This thing's called Kickstarter. That's the name of the website that you're going to be sent to in the TV viewer. It's called crowdfunding. I mean, that's sort of the generic name for it. Kickstarter is just one of the crowdfunding type projects. But essentially what it is you post your intentions. I want to build a point-and-click adventure. Here's who I am. Here's why you should support this. People pledge money to say, listen, if you do produce it, this is the money that you'll end up getting, right? And they set a certain length of time. In 30 days, we need to raise $400,000 to make the project. And then people go in, just like a, you know, Jerry Lewis telethon, if you will, and they go in and they pledge money. And you pledge certain amounts, you know, they put a number up, and most of the time they say, okay, well, if you pledge this much, then you're going to get this. If you pledge this much, you're going to get this extra stuff. And if you even do more, then you'll get this, blah, blah, blah. So there are tons of people. Now, just to show how this actually works, this is amazing to me. So let's check this out. So here we go. So, if you pledge $15 or more, you'll get the finished game and all of its awesome DRM glory, exclusive access to the beta, access to the video series online, access to the private discussion community. Okay? That's if you pledge $15. $1 minimum, of course. 35,000 people, 35,404 people pledged $15. That's an amazing number to me. Okay? Pledge 30 or more. HD download of the documentary series with extras, digital game soundtrack, and all the previous reward tiers. You get the $15 one too. 21,880 people have pledged $30. Okay? That's an amazing number to me as well. Now, pledged 100 or more, you get an original Double Fine Adventure poster suitable for framing, exclusive to the campaign, special thanks in the game's credits, and all previous reward tiers. Posters will be shipped for free in the U.S. Please add $10 to your pledge for international shipping. So that's $100 for that. 4,314 people made that pledge for $100. All right? Now here's the even more amazing one. Pledge $250 or more. Double Fine Adventure poster autographed by Tim Schafer, Ron Gilbert, and the rest of the design team, plus all the previous rewards. They had 900 openings for that. In other words, they would take 900 donations at that price, or pledges at that price, and that was it. They're sold out. 900 people pledged $250 or more. All right, next up. $1,000 or more. Mini portrait of you painted by the game's artist, plus all the previous reward tiers. They had slots for 100 of those. $100,000 pledges. Sold out. 100 backers pledged $1,000 or more. Okay? $5,000 or more. Larger original painting of art used in the final game, plus all previous reward tiers. 10 slots were open for $5,000. 10 people pledged. Finally, pledged $10,000 or more. They have 4 slots open. Lunch with Tim Schafer and Ron Gilbert, a tour of the Double Fine offices, and all the previous rewards. There are more rewards, but we can't post them here because they're too big. For premium rewards past $10,000 pledge, see doublefine.com. They have slots for 4. 2 of those are already filled for $10,000 or more. I find this a fascinating social experiment, if nothing else. Right? Not just a social experiment, but also possibly a future business model. I mean, think about it. You've got people, you have just like starving artists, right? You've got thousands of developers out there that are brilliant. They can create great software, right? What they don't have is the might of EA or Gameloft or whatever behind them. They're brilliant, but no money. This amazes me that 63,000 plus people have pledged almost $2.1 million, and they still have 8 days to go. 18 days to go. Does that blow your mind? That blows my mind. Imagine if a couple of the guys from Epix or Paul Norman, right, decided he wanted to do a new Forbidden Forest. Something like that. Right? They don't have EA behind them. They don't have, you know, Cosme's no more. They don't have any of these big people behind them. You can go up here to Kickstarter and actually possibly get funded. I'm totally amazed. I'm blown away that this works. Now, the real question is the people who pledge actually come up with the money, you know, just like anything else. But, hey, I mean, there's tons of projects you can browse through at Kickstarter here and see what other people are doing and what they're trying to create and, you know, how much they're funded and all this stuff. It's fascinating to me that this could become a legitimate business means of funding. And making money and getting projects. It blows me away. It blows me away. I'm glad to see it, and I'm dying to see how this all works out. Nintendo Nerds wrote in. These guys, of course, are hardcore, diehard Nintendo fans. And they wrote in to let me know that they are, working on a revamp of their website, which contains a new feature, which is a games database. Now, I've tried to start game databases in the past for Nintendo DS, Nintendo 3DS, and to be honest, it's very hard to get a momentum going for this sort of thing. So I applaud people that keep trying. But now here's the cool part. The games database features over 750 games, which currently contain NES, Super NES, N64, GameCube, Wii, and Wii U. I don't know what's in the Wii U catalog yet, but they've got a slot for it. Game & Watch, these are portables. Game & Watch, Game Boy, Game Boy Color, Game Boy Advance, Nintendo DS, and Nintendo 3DS. Now, I can personally tell you that when I was running just the Nintendo DS piece, we had 3,000 titles in there. So they've got a long way to go. But I can also tell you that people in this position that are building these sort of apps for you on the web, they need the support, even not financially need the support, but they need to see that people are signing up, that people are registering, and that people are using the product that they're putting together. Now, maybe you can't catalog all your DS games based on what they have up there right now. But if they see it being used, believe me, it will drive them to keep doing it. And I'm sure that there's a means, and I haven't had a chance to poke through the whole deal yet. I just browsed through the database a little bit. Did I mention that you can, like, make your own collection off of this thing? You can add games to your collection and it tracks them? Yeah, okay. So these sort of people like myself and developers that are doing this sort of thing really need to see that support. Just by adding what you have would be useful. They can see activity. They can see they're not wasting their time. So that's nice to see that people are working on that. Games are being added every day. New features are always being worked on. And behind the scenes to give our members more control and interactivity. Let's see. What else did the guy say? I wanted to make sure that, yeah, okay, that sounds pretty good. So go over and check it out. Of course, we'll give you the link there, NintendoNerds.com, for those who are not in front of the TV viewer. It looks like a good project. It looks like something you'll want to support. So go check it out and see if they would make your collection life any easier. Now, I'm going to end the Bits and Bytes segment with something important. You may or may not know the name Jamie Woodhouse. Now, you should know the name, especially if you're listening to this show and you're an old fan of the Commodore Amiga. If it sounds familiar, it's because this guy made many, many great games for the Commodore Amiga, including, get this, one of my all-time favorite games, Nitro. And you've heard me talk about Nitro a million times in the past. It's a top-down racing game. It's frickin' brilliant. It had one of my favorite intros of all time. And it was published by Psygnosis. And, you know, of course, Psygnosis always had the greatest stuff. They knew talent when they saw it. Well, Jamie is now a developer for the portable marketplace and for the PC. The other game you may know of that I've mentioned many, many times before? Quack. Remember the quirky platformer that you played with two players on a split screen? I've talked about it a million times. And Now, he did make a Game Boy Advance version, which I talked about ages and ages ago. Limited number of copies, printed actual cartridges, you didn't need a flash cart. I still have mine. I gotta have to get Jamie to sign it at some point. But anyway, so Jamie would like me to helpfully point out that he's stepping out of the PC and working on mobile games. Unfortunately, I can't get Jamie to seem to move over to the Android, so everything he does is purely iOS, which is probably fine for some of you. You know, there's plenty of Apple fans out there. But first of all, Quack is available. Now, I've always told Jamie that I thought the magic of Quack was kind of ruined by scrolling screens. And that was one of the reasons why I didn't play the Game Boy Advance one as much as I should. I'd actually rather fire up an emulator and play the real deal. You can get Quack on the PC and the Mac, too, which is probably the better way to play it. Now it's available on the iPhone. So you can get that. And, of course, it's beautiful cartoony graphics, old-school retro gameplay. It's a no-brainer. So Quack is still one of my favorite Amiga games of all time, and Jamie was behind that. Now, we talk about Nitro. Nitro was just a brilliant game. I could spend hours talking about Nitro. But Jamie has now made Nitro into an iOS game called Retro Racing, and I imagine it's probably because Psygnosa still owns the pink slip to Nitro somewhere. So that just got released on the iPhone, and he also wanted me to let you know that there is a Quack version coming to iPad as well. So he's got a lot of stuff in the pipeline. And again, this is an ex-Amiga developer. The guy knows what he's doing on these mobile, portable, tight-knit platforms. So you'll want to keep an eye on that. You can go to Mr. Quack, Q-W-A-K, MrQuack.com, and check out all of his stuff. Do me a favor. Just so Jamie can see that you heard about it on the show, if you contact him or you make a purchase or anything and you got that little extra notes field, just say heard it on Retro Gaming Radio. We're trying to build up build up our listenership again after being offline for so long. So I'd like to be able to show these sort of vendors and developers that we're important and that we, you know, when they have a new project, they should contact us because we can get them results and get people in their seats. That works well for us. So anytime you contact anybody with reference to something we talked about on the show, pass that along. But Jamie Woodhouse is a great guy. He's always in great communications with me. He's always sending me his stuff, and it's a great guy. So help him out. Support the project. And listen, if retro racing is anything at all, and it does look exactly like Nitro, then you guys are in for a huge, huge treat. Now, I'm not going to go out and buy an iPhone or an iPad to play this game, but based on the graphics that I'm seeing, where's the video? He has no video? What's up with that? Jamie, where's my video? Do I have no video on here? I got screenshots, but where's my video? Anyway, the screenshots look exactly like Nitro. So check it out. So if you want to see Nitro in action, go hit YouTube. I'm sure you'll find a link to it. And Alex has probably already provided you with one in the RGR Plus TV window because that's the kind of guy he is. But check it out. Fantastic stuff. Again, the guy deserves your support. Well, gang, that's going to wrap it up for Bits and Bytes. Remember, most of the articles here are funded by you guys. So bitsandbytes@retrogamingradio.com. Send those in. That's Bytes, B-Y-T-E-S, bitsandbytes@retrogamingradio.com. Send us your submissions. You'll get it. You'll hear it right here on the air. It's good stuff. But let's get on with the rest of the show. Along with the great hardware review with Alex J. Lopez this month, we're going to be looking at another emulator, a classic gaming emulator for iOS and the Android platform. This is neo.emu or .mu. This is Robert Broglie's brain trust, this whole .mu series, and he's got tons of them. We've talked about some of these before in the past, of course, but just to give you an idea, he's got a Mega Drive, a Nintendo, Super Nintendo, PC Engine, just absolute tons of great emulators. And what makes his emulators great are he makes them all look and behave the same, despite the fact that he uses different engines created by other authors. The other great thing about his emulators are they offer some form of direct connection to a wireless controller. I typically like to use the Wiimote controller, simply because it's light, it's portable, it's kind of NES style, it's got a D-pad, a couple of nice buttons, it's small, and most of the things that I do are 2-3 button games, so it works absolutely just fine. The Broglie line of emulators all include some means of doing that. They also include ICP and JS1. I'm not sure what those are. Maybe those are, I believe one of them, the ICP is an iCade controller that's used primarily on iOS. And JS1 I'm not completely sure of, but he does have built-in Wii Remote connectivity, which is absolutely fantastic for me. He also offers standard things like save slots and those sort of things. The things that you would actually hope that you would have in an emulator. Let's see. What else can I tell you? I mean, emulators are pretty much, emulators. What makes them different are the features and how compatible they are. Now, most of you know I'm not a huge Neo Geo fan, but there are a handful of Neo Geo games that I do like. Once you've hooked the controller up to the Neo emulator, you are then able to use the controller as a navigator for the emulator. So you get it hooked up. So let's say, for example, you have your tablet, your Asus Transformer or Transformer Prime with HDMI out plugged into your TV, and you're sitting on the couch with your Wii remote control. Now you can actually navigate the menu, start a game, exit a game, etc., without actually having to get up and use the tablet itself. One of the other very nice features, especially about the Neo.emu, is a lot of times you keep ROMs or game images in some sort of an odd short form zip file, right? Like T-Rally, that's Thrash Rally. That's pretty much easy to figure out, but there are many other games that the names don't really give you a whole lot of clue what they are. So when you go to load a game, you don't have to figure out, I wonder which zip file it is. This has a games list that parses all the zip files in the last folder you were in and gives you the name of the actual game, which is very nice. So instead of, Sea Sword, it's Cross Swords. Instead of, M-Lord, Maj-Lore, or something like that, it's Magician Lord, Set 1. Neo Mr. Do, whatever. Well, that's very nice. It's very nice if you happen to have a large set of games and a lot of very poorly named zips. As always, with emulators, you'll have to provide the basic BIOS or the ROM startup, and that's available, of course, if you know where to look. It can't be emulated. It can't be put into the game for legal reasons. But the emulator is very, very clean. It's very simple, but effective. That's what I like about his stuff. Now, as per usual, Neo.emu is based on another emulator, which is GNGO. Yeah, that's right. Which is based on an open source project that you could find at Google's code repository. But what Robert does is he takes that, he integrates it seamlessly within his UI, does a crap load of testing, and then releases it for iOS and for Android. So he charges, which I don't have a problem with at all. It's not like all he's doing is taking the emulator and slapping his name on it and then putting it out there. He actually does a considerable amount of work getting everything lined up. There's a lot of the emulators that he has that are usually kind of a pain in the butt to use if you were to be using the root core emulation piece of it. But the fact that he puts the nice menu around it and makes it very, very easy to use is really what makes it worth paying for. As for Neo Geo emulation itself, I'm not a huge Neo Geo fan. I won't lie to you. I do like a handful of games, and the handful of games that I like are things like Thrash Rally and Magician Lord. I do like, what was some of the other ones that I enjoyed? I did enjoy some of the side-scrolling platformers, because I do like that kind of game, Metal Slug. There's a handful of other ones I do like. But what I've seen, apparently Neo Geo, especially on older hardware or less powerful hardware, is really a pain. The ROMs take an entirely way too much memory to store, and accessing that memory apparently is always a problem for Neo Geo emulators. The people who are really diehard Neo Geo fans who are using this emulator now say it's one of the best ones they've ever seen, and this is on a portable device. This is on a mobile phone or on a tablet device. It was even better than on their PC. So apparently it does the job, right? It does the job very well. And the games that I play don't have any problems with them. Thrash Rally, Neo Geo, Mr. Do, they all play and sound just fine. So when it comes to emulators, you know, that's what you're worried about, the quality of the emulation. Sure, the extras are nice, but you need to have a good full experience. And that's what his emulators give you. Now, as a bonus, he'll give you a list of all of the games. See, this is why it's worth the money. He does all this testing for you, so you don't have to worry about, is it going to work with the game that I want it to play with before I go and fork out the $3-4 bucks? Well, he's got a list of all the Neo Geo games that he's tried or that he's had people try, and he lists the ones, and if they don't have a note by them, they work fine. So let me give you a list of the ones that aren't perfect. Fatal Fury 2, corrupt graphics. Irritating Maze locks up. Jockey Grand Prix locks up. Sound issues on King of Fighter 2000 and 2002. Some missing graphics on 2001. And lockup with 2003. It looks like King of Fighters might be the one game that it's not very friendly with. At least the 2000 editions. The 1990 ones look fine. Metal Slug, let's see. Metal Slug 5 has a lockup issue. Pachi and Naya has no sound, missing graphics in Prehistoric Isle 2. You're probably reading this list right along with me if you're watching the RJR Plus TV. Riding Hero has missing graphics, Rage of the Dragons has missing graphics, Strikers 1945 has missing graphics, lockups on the Showdown 5, Samurai Showdown 5 series, Shengoku 3 has missing graphics, lockup on SNK versus Capcom, CPU reboots on V-Liner. And missing graphics on Zupapa. So, there you go. If I did not call the name, then it works fine. Thrash Rally's good. Let's see, I'm trying to think of, let me run through this list as I go through. Puzzle to Pawn, that's usually a big favorite. Bust a Move, all good. Let's see, Neo Mr. Do, Neo Drift Out, yeah, Ninja Commando, most of the Metal Slugs. So, you're all good. So, I highly recommend that you check out Robert Broglia's line of emulators. They all end with .emu. That's how you know you're getting the right one. Most of them cost. Some of them are free. But I tell you, if you want quality emulation on these portable devices, you're going to pay a couple bucks. And if you buy a .emu, you know it's going to be quality. Well, I hope this helps you guys out and give you another good review of a product that you can use to enjoy classic and retro gaming on your modern devices. Don't forget, next up we have Alex J. Lopez and myself talking about his new interesting imported Chinese piece of Wii U controller knockoff that runs Android games and classic games, of course. So stick with us.
This is Shane R. Monroe with Retro Gaming Radio. I'm here with our producer, the esteemed Alex J. Lopez. Welcome, Alex. This is your first appearance on Retro Gaming Radio, like, ever, isn't it?
I think it is, actually.
That's fantastic. Now, Alex is no stranger to podcasting or anything like that. He's done several shows, including his own famous Wii Minute Radio.
There was some less than critical acclaim there, but
yeah, we did. What did we do? We did that Monroe World Gamecast. We did a couple of those, and
those
showed
were
up
fun.
On dual screen radio a couple times, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. So anyway, well, what we're here to talk about is Alex is a gadget freak, just like a lot of us are. And he decided to go out and pick up this interesting Chinese gaming tablet. The official name is the JXD S7100. So complicated. And this is actually an Android gaming tablet. So I'm going to let Alex give you the once-over on this, and I'm going to ask questions, and we'll get everything answered up.
Yeah, so basically this, they call it, on the sites that sell the device, they call it a retro gaming Android tablet, if I'm not mistaken. But they're pretty quick to specify that it's for retro gaming because it's completely aimed at the emulation solutions that are out for Android. So really, first thing I'd say about the device, if you're looking to get your feet wet and into the world of Android, this is probably not the device you're going to want to pick up as your first Android device. It'll frustrate you to no end as an Android device. But where it shines is as a gaming emulation device, similar to GP2X Canoe, which is a gadget that I picked up not too long ago, actually a couple months ago. And it's what got me really into trying to find the perfect retro gaming handheld. I've got an Asus Transformer, like a lot of the folks on the forums do now, and been taking advantage of a lot of the great emulation solutions that are out there. The Robert Broglia stuff that Shane has talked about on Retro Gaming Radio, it's fantastic emulators and feature rich. I think, you know, a lot of the emulators on Android right now are getting more attention than even the PC emulators that are out there. So being able to get that kind of attention on a handheld was kind of an attractive proposition for me. What I was initially looking into was possibly getting an Xperia Play, which is Sony's Android phone that's got physical controls or slide out physical controls on the device. And you know, getting a new phone means usually committing to a 2-year contract, which is something I'm not ready to do with a phone like the Xperia Play, which has been out for a while.
Yeah, I think you made the right decision on that one.
Yeah, you know, and coincidentally, the Mobile World Conference is going on. I believe it starts this weekend, and I'm hoping they announce a new Xperia Play or potentially some Android phones with physical controls from maybe another manufacturer. But yeah, so, you know, doing a little digging around, some of you may have seen an article that was floating around. I think Kotaku picked it up, Gizmodo and Engadget, and some of the other gaming sites and gadget sites, where they had this Android tablet that pretty much looks like the Wii U controller. It's white. They have a black one also, but it's a 7-inch widescreen tablet with physical controls on it. You've got the D-pad on the left with an analog thumb slider on the left as well, and you've got your four buttons on the right and a start and a select button or half buttons on the right. So I decided to look into it, and as it turns out, it was pretty early on when they first came out, and they were selling them at a couple of sites. I found one site that had the white ones for sale for $140. So as far as Android tablets go, and you know, even comparing it to the GB2X Canoe, which runs about $160, $180, I thought that was a really good deal. So I decided, you know what, let me pick this thing up. Let me check it out and see, you know, what I could do with it.
Yeah, $140. I think the GP, what did you pay for the GP2X back then when you got that?
I think it was like $159, if I'm not mistaken, and that was from ThinkGeek. But I think normally they run most of the sites about 180.
Yeah. 140 seemed to be pretty low for that sort of product. Now, originally you thought it was going to be a capacitive touchscreen, right? You got to tell the story about this because this is like the best.
Yeah, absolutely. And that it kind of drives kind of some of the frustration of using this thing as an Android device. When the thing first hit the scene on the internet, and all those websites I mentioned started to post articles about it, I went to the manufacturer's website and a couple of the online retailers' websites that were selling them, and they all had they didn't mention capacitive or resistive.
No, of course.
But they all had a YouTube video showing a guy playing Fruit Ninja and a ton of other games that can only be played with a capacitive setup. As you know, Fruit Ninja, you're trying to slice 4 and 5, you know, pieces of fruit at the same time. It's
right.
Not going to quite work with a resistive screen. So I just assumed, you know, that it would be a capacitive screen, and of course it ended up being the resistive version. You know, the place I got it from, it's a site called iShareGifts.com. You know, they I can't necessarily recommend them. I mean, they did ship it. The shipping was a little slow. It came from it was shipped from Hong Kong. It took a little over a month to receive it. It didn't arrive in good condition and everything else, but I really didn't like the way they handled the whole situation with resistive versus capacitive, because a couple of weeks later, when I went to buy the device, it was $140. You had a choice between black and white. When I received it and I realized that, you know, we had an issue with the screen. I went back to the listing, and then they had a capacitive and a resistive choice. And the resistive one had been the price had been bumped up to $150, and the capacitive one's $180. So
of course,
I guess that makes a little more sense in terms of what you get for your money, but.
That price difference, that price difference isn't actually that bad. You know, most tablets, the difference is literally $100 for a 7-inch guy.
Between, yeah, you'd think.
So it was a difference of $40. That's not that bad.
Yeah, man. It's one of those things. After waiting, 5 weeks for it to arrive from Hong Kong, I wasn't ready to pop it back in the box and send it away.
Yeah, exactly.
And when you pick up an Android device with the sole purpose of having physical controls on it, you don't return it because you don't like the touch screen text.
That's true.
If I had picked it up from the local Best Buy, I probably would have returned it and grabbed the capacitive. But I'm funny about returning things to begin with, so I just decided to hang on to it.
Like Best Buy would carry anything that cool.
Yeah, exactly. And you know what? There's clearly a market for those people who want these physical controls. Somebody's got to do this like legitimately. You know, a Samsung or whomever, Acer or Asus. But getting back into the device again, it's a 7-inch screen. It's a little longer than you'd expect, like a normal tablet, even though the screen perspective is the typical 16:9 or whatever. But because of the actual physical controls, it makes it seem like a longer device. I'll hold it up to the screen there. So
it does look, very long.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
Those of you watching this on RGR Plus TV, you'll probably get a chance to see it at this point.
Yeah. And just going through the motions here, you got three buttons across the front, your Android buttons. You got your back, your home, and your menu. And I mentioned your D-pad, and it's kind of original PlayStation or PlayStation 1 setup.
Right.
Where you've got your four button D-pad and your four buttons set up.
Right.
Over here, you've got it's very similar to a PSP Go slider pad.
Gotcha.
That's under that. Now, one thing I should mention about that is the system's running Froyo, Android 2.2.1. And Android operating system doesn't detect analog joysticks until Gingerbread, until 3.0. So what you basically got there is just a glorified D-pad that has a little play in it. The analog stick and the D-pad are not independently mappable. So if you map up on the D-pad, it's the same thing as if you're going up on the analog slide. So that's kind of, not ideal, obviously. But there's a pretty, what I think is a decent sized community of folks working on creating a ROM for the device.
That's
and,
good.
They've got a section developed, or a section dedicated to it on XDA developers. And we should start to see at least a Gingerbread build for this, if not Ice Cream Sandwich at some point. It's certainly capable. I mean, we've seen some pretty shabby tablets dropping with Ice Cream Sandwich all over them without a problem. So I can't imagine it would be an issue.
Right.
But it'll be interesting to see if upgrading to Gingerbread at least would allow kind of the independent use of that slider pad.
Now, a lot of people who are listening, retro gamers, may not be ultimately familiar with Android and how it works as an operating system. Essentially, Android is really a lightweight, based on Linux, a very interesting flavor of Linux, open source operating system. So when he's talking about custom ROMs and doing things like that, essentially it's Android is meant to be hacked on. I mean, Google released the source, Open Code, and you can go and actually download the stuff and tinker with it yourself. So XDA, which is a huge website for this sort of development, they constantly have new devices added on, like this device, the 7100, and the community will find a drop of the original firmware for this thing, and they'll tear it apart, and they'll add little pieces to it or make modifications to it. And it's a huge, huge deal, this whole Android thing. A lot of people don't understand why, you know, there are people who are really, really bent on Android versus, you know, iPhone or iOS. And that's really it. This is the sort of thing that Apple's not going to let a device like this slide through the system. You're not ever going to see an Apple device like this. Whereas on Android, you know, it's free. These Chinese manufacturers can pull it off the site, monkey with it all they want, and just throw it on whatever piece of hardware they want. So
yeah, I mean, you can't even get MAME in the App Store from Apple. Right. You know, they consider that contraband. But while a Pokemon app, you know, slips through, and a Pokemon app that doesn't work and isn't authorized by Nintendo, that slips on through and becomes the top paid app in the App Store, but no, MAME gets taken down.
So. Yeah, it really is priceless. But we're not here to talk about the Apple versus Android stuff. We want to talk about this guy.
Oh, come on.
Yeah, I know. You know, we'll save this for a different show. The reason we're talking about this product today is the fact that it is a retro gaming tablet. Now, you're probably saying to yourself, well, you know, why can't I get an iPad? Why don't I get an iPad or even a Transformer or a Samsung Galaxy or what's the other, Motorola Zoom? What's going to really separate this product from those products?
Yeah, so for me, the holy grail is integrated physical controls.
Yeah, there you go.
I mean, I've got a Transformer, and it works really well with all kinds of controllers. I mean, it's got native support for PS3 six-axis gamepads. It'll play nice with Xbox 360 gamepads. You can Bluetooth sync a Wiimote in seconds. And, you know, these Robert Broglie, I can't say enough about the Robert Broglie emulators. They natively support the Wiimote just right out of the box. You just, you know, hold down two buttons and sync and you're set. You know, pretty much any Android device is going to get you on board with gaming, with controllers. But God, there's something about having this device in your hand that's got the controls built in. You can lay in bed and play it. You know, this is a 7-inch screen too. This is not some dinky little, you know, Game Boy screen. This is a large, bright screen. The speakers are both loud and they're quality speakers. They've got good sound definition. You know, the resolution on the device is 800 by 480. So, you know, if you're playing, even N64 or PS1 emulation, you're getting that upscaled. So that's pretty nice. And you know, what this did for me that, the Canoe couldn't do was that, on the higher end of the more, troublesome, systems to emulate, like the Super Nintendo and the N64. Obviously, the Canoe can't run N64. You can run games like Super Mario RPG, which chokes on the Canoe, but runs really well on the, I guess we'll call this the 7100, so we don't choke on that name every time. but yeah, you know, you can... It's got an ARM Cortex A9 800 megahertz CPU. Now there's word out there that some of these things are shipping with gigahertz of CPUs in them. So I think there are a couple models floating around. Some of them have Bluetooth, some of them don't have Bluetooth. The one I have does not have Bluetooth. There are a couple of different stock ROMs floating out there if you got the capacitive version or the resistive version.
Yeah, I was just going to say that's actually you got a controller, you got a device with physical controls, so you've got access to essentially two four-way controllers, so you can do. We're going to talk more about Robotron and dual stick shooters and things like that in a minute. What you don't have is that Bluetooth syncing capability, which I just wanted to point out that really limits external physical controls. And right, that, right, to me, that would be probably the biggest showstopper of a device like this, only because the device that you have there, the 7100, does have HDMI out, which says to me, I need to be plugged into a television like yesterday. So exactly, in order for you to do that and go sit on your couch, there's no way to wire up a remote, you know, a distance wireless type controller to make that happen.
And lack of Bluetooth is a real showstopper if you're planning on setting this on, in your entertainment center and sitting back on the couch, because it does have the HDMI out, so it's really curious that they would include something like that. Making matters worse, I finally got to try the USB Joy, and
good. I wanted to hear about this.
Yeah, unfortunately, I can't get anything to recognize outside of just standard storage. Like the US, it's got a mini USB plug with a standard USB size input for as a dongle. I can plug in jump drives. I can plug in hard drives. Can't plug in any devices. I didn't try a mouse, but I wasn't able to try any, or I wasn't able to get any controllers to come up or be recognized using USB Joy. So I didn't get to play with it for very long. So you know, there may be, you know, some hope to that, but I wasn't seeing any life when I gave it a try this afternoon.
Yeah, and what's really unfortunate about that is there's a lot of phones, actual cell phones, that don't have a complete Bluetooth profile. They're missing the human interface device profile, which is your mouse, your keyboards, and unfortunately controllers. My guess would be, without knowing any different, that this device suffers that same fate. If you try to plug a mouse or a keyboard or a controller in, I'm guessing we won't get anything out of it, which is too bad. Because even then, you could at least use a 2.4 gigahertz wireless PS3 controller. That could get you that unit sitting by the TV, plugged in through HDMI, and that have you on the couch with the controller. But so this isn't going to help you in that fact, so don't let that HDMI get you really excited unless you got like a 60-foot cable or something to run it back to the couch.
Now, a few other specs that I think are relevant. It's got 8 gigabytes on board, which isn't great, but it does have a micro SD slot, so you can plug a 32 gigabyte micro SD card in there, and you've got all the storage you need.
Yeah, you've already lost the iDevices there.
Yeah, and I do recommend fast memory, because before I had my 32 gig, which is a 10 level
class,
or 10 speed, or class 10.
Right.
I had a 16, or I think it was an 8 or a 16 laying around that was a 4. And it was a world of difference when I plugged the class 10 in. It really, really made a difference, especially in an N64 and that kind of thing.
Go ahead. Mm-hmm.
Just a couple other things. It's got a headphone jack, standard 2.5 headphone jack.
How's the quality on that? You know how a lot of these cheap devices, you're afraid to plug in headphones because it doesn't feel real solid?
No, it's very tight, and you don't get that tinny when it moves, that tinny sound or anything.
That's good.
It's very tight, and it, you know, works fine. Like I said, the built-in speakers are surprisingly good and loud, because sometimes with devices like this, you get either loud or quality, you know, so
right.
it was nice to get both on this. And then the last bit was the battery. It's got a built-in, 3800,
milliamp
rechargeable battery built
this in. It's retro techie radio.
Yeah. And I'm getting, they say it's about 5 hours. I'm getting probably 3 or 4, because all I do is game with it. I don't read Kindle books or surf the web on it. I usually don't even have Wi-Fi turned on it, because all I do is game on it. That's what it's for.
Is it a removable battery? Is that something you can replace?
Or? No.
No.
Well, the screws are pretty accessible. It's not removable in the traditional sense, but I'm sure that you could crack this thing open and do pretty much whatever you want with it. But it does have a front-facing and rear-facing camera. Nothing to write home about there. The quality's not very good, even with the third-party camera software. But it's there in case you want to take some pictures.
All right, so now we know the device is rootable, and if you're, for those of you who are non-Android friendly, you can think of this as sort of, I don't even hate to even equate it to the term jailbreak, but essentially it gives you administrative rights to the unit. Android, just like any other operating system, has different levels of security, and normally you would log in as a user, which only gives you access to non-system areas of the device. When you root the device and give yourself root access, you can then get to all the areas of the device, which really open up a lot of things like custom ROMs, running apps that require system-level access to do, to perform.
Not to mention clearing out Chinese apps that you don't need.
Yeah, we're going to get to that. Yeah, what the thing gets loaded with, that's a fascinating piece of the story. So the important thing is, especially if you're an Android-type person, you're curious, yes, it's been rooted. You said there were a couple of stock ROMs out there already for it, or no?
There are, and, you know, it depends on which version you have. There are two out there that I know of that are for the resistive version. I know a lot of people are putting the resistive one on their capacitive and vice versa, and they're ending up bricking their devices.
Oops.
So I'd be real careful with that. I'm not flashing this thing with any, you know, stock ROM until they offer me something like Gingerbread or something just
sure.
Really worthwhile. Otherwise, you know, I'd love to hit up like a, what is it, Cyanogen
mod. Cyanogen mod.
Yeah, those guys really are
a better worse name than that. Maybe they should call that the 7100 mod. That'd be easier.
Yeah, those guys. There's rumor that those guys may support the device at some point as well. So I'd love to, you know, try something like that. But in the meantime, you know, when you turn this thing on, when you pull it out of the box, which it comes in a really attractive box, by the way. I was really surprised. Everything about this thing is I mean, it's almost an Apple Store quality box with like cushions on the inside, and they came with a pair of white earbud headphones and the whole. I mean, all that stuff comes from China anyway, so I guess it's not too big a stretch.
Hey, when you send an email from it, does it add sent by iPhone at the bottom of it for you?
I wouldn't be surprised. No, it does not. But you know, something that's actually kind of funny. When you load up the camera app the first time, you get, there's one picture in there that's a picture. The rest of them are like pictures they save from the internet or wallpapers or whatever. But the one picture that's in there is a picture, mine was of this lady, like probably the quality assurance lady at Foxconn or something. And she just took a picture of herself with the camera, and she's just got this like frown on her face, like she's just making sure it worked or whatever.
That's funny.
That picture somewhere. It's actually pretty funny.
You'll have to post that on the RGR Plus TV player. All right, so enough of the system specs. I know most people are interested. Well, what kind of emulation am I going to get out of this, and how does it perform? So let's talk about that. So out of the box, you said this thing comes preloaded with a bunch of stuff it probably shouldn't be preloaded with.
Yeah, I mean the thing first of all comes preloaded with like every popular mobile game, Angry Birds, Plants vs. Zombies, the latest Asphalt racing. It comes with just tons of that stuff pre-installed. Like I guess they're the Japanese versions of them. Or they might be Chinese. I can't tell the difference in terms of their writing and that kind of thing, but it's definitely not the US versions. Like Fruit Ninja's on there, and of course you try to play it, you can't because it's a resistive screen, so that's disappointing. But the one thing I would mention before we get into the emulation and everything, Asphalt played phenomenally with the gyro sensor in this thing.
That seems crazy that a $140 tablet would play Asphalt.
Yeah, and you know, not only did it perform well, and other games like Riptide, for whatever reason, my Tegra optimized version of Riptide works on it.
What?
It looks great. Yeah, it's pretty weird. It's pretty, and it actually says optimized for Tegra across the bottom.
That's bizarre.
But I think the gyro sensor in this thing is better than the one in the Transformer.
Wow.
Because
really?
I went back and played Asphalt on the Transformer, and it could be the shape of the device. Maybe it's just a little more comfortable in the hands, but it just felt better. I was crashing into the walls and everything less. And, driving with the gyro sensor has never, been that accurate for me, but it felt pretty good on this device. In addition to that, it comes preloaded with tons and tons and tons of ROMs. And what they do is they create apps where I'm not sure how the mechanics of this works, but rather than loading an emulator or starting an emulator app and then loading a ROM, they create an app that's got like a Mario picture as the app icon. And when you click that, it loads the emulator and the ROM at the same time, and you're playing Super Mario 64 like immediately. So it makes it seem like it's the Super Mario 64 app, when in reality, it's just, it's got all these, emulators like baked into the stock ROM.
Interesting. I think that doesn't, like the Wii and the virtual console and stuff are sort of the same way. I think somebody tore apart like the Commodore 64, what did they release for the Commodore 64 on the Wii? What was the one or two titles they released?
There was like International Karate.
Yeah, that's what it was. They took International Karate, they decoupled the ROM from it, and they injected other ROMs into it. So instead of having a standalone International Karate that was based on an emulator that had the ROM pre-injected into it, they went and they took, Iridium or something, and they injected that into it in place of International Karate. So that's interesting. I wonder if they've got any tools out there that would let you inject ROMs into these sort of things. That'd be an interesting thing.
Yeah.
But who cares? You don't even need that because you can just use the regular emulator.
Right. But I guess the focus on the stuff that comes preloaded is N64, PS1, Game Boy Advance, and Sega Genesis. And I thought it was curious that they didn't focus on, they didn't include any Super Nintendo, until I realized, probably the second biggest drawback of this device, after the Bluetooth, and that's it. There are no shoulder buttons on this thing. Yeah, if you create a device that showcases physical controls and you forget the shoulder buttons, that's not a good thing.
No.
depending on what you're playing, Super Nintendo, a lot of Super Nintendo games require those shoulder buttons, and you can map them to other things. There are a lot of creative ways to get around that. If it's like an RPG that uses the shoulder buttons just to bring up maps or something.
Sure.
Then you can keep the on-screen shoulder buttons and just tap those with your forefinger or your thumb or something. But if it's something that uses the shoulder button as a trigger or something, you're kind of out of luck.
Yeah.
On this device, so Super Nintendo not the best choice here. Now Game Boy Advance on the other hand has shoulder buttons, but only has two face buttons. So you can take like the X and the Y and assign those to as shoulder buttons.
Creative ways to get around the limitations.
So that's kind of, it comes preloaded with a bunch of that stuff. And you got to root the program you use to root the 7100 it's called Visionary Plus. And I'll put a lot of this stuff up on the forums so that if anyone decides to get the device or has a device that's looking to do some of this stuff. But the route that seems to be the popular one, that's just a one-click route, is the Visionary Plus. And that will give you access to add a different launcher, because the standard launcher on this thing, it doesn't have like the standard Android launcher. It's just not even in there. In fact, it doesn't even have an Android keyboard. So you have to add a keyboard in order to type on it.
That's crazy.
So, they really stripped it down. They took like an appliance approach to the thing.
Right.
Which is, if you ask me, that's kind of, it kind of defeats the purpose a little bit. It kind of takes away a little bit of the potential, but it's easily remedied once you root and you can add the Google Market or the Android Marketplace on there and download a couple of things. I downloaded like the ice cream sandwich keyboard, and that enabled me to be able to type and do things, and a few other items that were important to get on there in order to start customizing and getting rid of that launcher. Talking about these launchers, one of the great things about having a device like this on Android as opposed to, for example, the Canoe, is that you can just get all kinds of creative with some of the launchers that are out there. One of the cool things that I did was that I created a launcher for emulators that was basically a reproduction of the Wii system menu. So it basically had the Wii system menu. It had channels with each emulator on it, and you could tap the channel and it would launch the emulator.
That's just so damn cool.
So you can start doing all kinds of cool stuff. What I found is that, since I did that, it was really cool. I played around with it for a couple of days and then I wiped it out. I find that the less fancy you get with this thing, the more you just stick to the emulators, the less problems you have, because it does tend to crash. The Froyo build is a little unstable. Right now I have just a generic launcher. I think it's ADW, I think it's called.
Right.
And just a live wallpaper running on it and just my icons for each one of my emulators.
Okay, well, let's move on to the emulation piece of it. So tell us what you've tested, not necessarily which emulator, but what systems you've emulated, and give us just a quick little synopsis on each one as to how well you feel the device performs for that task.
All right. Well, right off the bat, starting with Atari 2600, works flawlessly. And I would say anything from Robert Baraglia, any of his emulators, and I'm pulling up the list of them right now. Anything that this guy has out there, it works just flawlessly with the program. That includes, with the device. Game Boy Color, works great, works fantastic. Sega Genesis, NES, Neo Geo Pocket, TurboGrafx-16. Super Nintendo, like I said, the emulator works fine. You don't have the shoulder buttons, so that's kind of a deal breaker depending on what games you're going to be playing.
Did you try any of those really weird Super Nintendo ROMs on it, those ones that emulators just tend to choke on religiously?
Yeah, I did actually. I put on Star Fox. The FX chips ones are the ones that usually have a problem.
Yeah.
Star Fox works on it, but it does stutter a little bit. It, the same as a lot of the desktop emulators.
Sure.
Would be. It's very, very comparable. It plays about as well as it does on my Transformers. So it's not so much a measure of a problem with the device. It's just, they just don't emulate those games very well. One of them, which was, a game, it probably was the game that made me say, okay, the Canoe isn't going to quite cut it for me. It was a Super Mario RPG, on SNES. The Canoe just chokes on it, and you can overclock all the way up to, I think, 800 megahertz or 900 megahertz on the Canoe, and it just can't, even the intro sequence, it just can't keep up with the music, and the frame rate just drops. It's not really playable. Runs silky smooth on this device, so I was really happy about that.
Wow.
Getting into the what I guess I call the OID emulators, which are they were kind of the best emulators out there before Robert Broglie's stuff was released. So Robert Broglie hasn't tackled N64 and he hasn't tackled GBA, so I used those for those two systems. Believe it or not, N64 runs for the games that run well in emulation, because I know a lot of folks try to run some of the obscure stuff and are disappointed. Banjo-Kazooie, which, you know, is one of the rare titles, runs fantastic on it. And, you know, the big problem here for any N64 game is that you're not going to have a true analog stick on this running for you. But in terms of frame rate and the ability to actually run the game, it's got the horsepower, and you can play Mario Kart 64 on it, Super Mario 64, Zelda Ocarina of Time, you know, the whole nine yards. Getting into some of the Commodore stuff, Amiga, unfortunately, and this thing kind of chokes on it. I tried quite a few games, in particular Super Frog, Brian the Lion. I tried some of the stuff that would seem like platformers would seem to be the kind of game I'd want to play with this type of controls. And it's just frame rate issues, and it would lock up on loading discs and that kind of thing. So I just kind of gave up on Amiga. I don't really use it on the device. Now Commodore 64, on the other hand, Frodo 64 is the emulator, runs great. And in fact, you can map the controller buttons right inside the emulator. So I loaded up, you know, Ghostbusters, I loaded up Choplifter, I loaded up Impossible Mission, Raid Over Moscow, and I was just loading up all kinds of stuff, and everything ran well. I mean, no problems. I think the one that I couldn't get to work, and it might be that just my copy of the game image was Karateka. For odd reason, I couldn't get it to run.
Interesting. And so now let's talk about, now of course we're tiptoeing around what everyone really wants to know about, and that is MAME, of course.
Yeah.
Let's talk about MAME.
You know, I'll tell you, MAME for All is the there are two MAME arcade emulators on Android, at least there was last time I checked. I don't know if there's anything else that might have popped up, but there's Jarcade and there's MAME for All. And Jarcade, for whatever reason, they does not recognize the buttons on this thing. I don't know why. I'm glad if I had to pick one of the two, I would have chosen MAME for All anyways.
Yeah, definitely.
But Jarcade, it just doesn't see the buttons. This is very strange, and I wonder if it also has that same issue with the Xperia Play, because what I find is that from everything that I've read, if it's supported by the Xperia Play, and Xperia Play is getting a lot of support from a lot of the game makers, and Roglia supports the Xperia Play, but if it supports the Xperia Play, it should support this device. MAME for All, no problems. And in fact, right inside the game settings or the emulator settings, very simple. You can map player 1 through 4. You mentioned earlier Robotron and some of the dual stick shooters. You can, or dual stick games, you can map them pretty much any way you want. So if you map your player 2 stick, to the buttons on the right, then you're pretty much set. You get your joystick 1 and your joystick 2, and you're ready to go. With Robotron specifically, I wouldn't say it's an ideal Robotron experience, and that's because it doesn't handle the diagonals very well. It handles them about as well as you'd expect from a D-pad, a four-way D-pad. You press down and up and left and you get your diagonal, but it's not something I'd sit and play Robotron on for hours. It did pass my Burger Time test, which is a big deal. At Burger Time, those ladders and getting up and down those ladders, and that to me is the test of any D-pad. And I've sat and played Burger Time for more than an hour on on this device in one sitting. And it's great. It's better than the iCade, which some of you may be familiar with. The iCade, which is the mini cabinet, Bluetooth cabinet that supports the Android Android devices as well as the iPad. But the problem with the iCade, of course, was the 8-way versus the 4-way. And this, I guess, has the opposite problem. It's designed for 4-way. And that benefits games like this Pac-Man and Burger Time. And yeah, I had a really good time playing MAME with this. The screen is just so crisp and pretty. And, you know, you can turn it over on its side and do portrait mode. But, you know, obviously the controls aren't quite set up right for that. I'm hoping that when and if we get a gingerbread build and I can get more out of this analog nub, if I can separate the analog nub from the D-pad, then that would be fantastic because you'd have a D-pad, you'd have a control stick on the right and you'd have four buttons on the left in portrait mode.
That would give you something to work with.
Yeah, that would be pretty cool. But you know what? It's a 7-inch screen, even in landscape mode with the for the games that are intended to be played in portrait mode. The screen's big enough, and it's sharp, and very, you know, you get a lot of good contrast and detail, and it's perfectly fine for playing in that orientation. I'm trying to think of what else I played on. I played a ton of Ms. Pac-Man on it. I played, I played Combat Tribes on it, which was a lot of fun. The Simpsons runs on it, really well.
Did you try any of the typically greedy, hungry MAME games, the upper level ones, the Mortal Kombats, the Atari
Mortal
System
Kombat
runs.
I did try Mortal Kombat, and Mortal Kombat runs great on it. The problem, obviously, is the controls aren't quite, you know, ideal for it. But yeah, I do tend to load up Mortal Kombat when testing out a new device to see how it runs. And yeah, I mean, in terms of horsepower, the horsepower is there, but that's probably another one I'd classify as not the ideal control layout for the device.
Did you play Narc by any chance? Because that's one of my favorite ones to test on. That's another greedy, horrifying Williams game that just eats up tons of memory and CPU. Plus, it's fully fun just blowing the hell up out of everybody, so that's good stuff.
Yeah. You know, I played a lot of Michael Jackson's Moonwalker.
That's funny.
Yeah.
Sure, there's not a Whitney Houston game you could play.
No, unfortunately, there's no Whitney Houston game. but yeah, you know, Michael Jackson's Moonwalker is kind of a guilty pleasure of mine, and that's one where diagonals are important, and it, you know, it works fine, and it's also got a lot of it's kind of an elaborate sound in that game and that kind of thing, and it does a pretty good job at handling that.
Now, it's worth noting, MAME for All is pretty much the same as it is on any other platform, PSP, GP2X, being in that it is the 0.37 build. Beta 11, I think, is the highest up it supports. And this is really important. A lot of people don't understand the generations of MAME. So let me talk about that for just a minute. So you had earlier builds of MAME that up to about, amazingly enough, up to 0.37, beta 11. Look at that. There it is. Right there on the screen. That's so sexy. MAME 0.37 was the last build before they put PROM support in. And what they did, somewhere between 0.37 and the later versions, they did a bunch of reorganizing under the hood. As I understand it, they split out CPU cores. They did a whole bunch of maintenance under the hood. And you also might know 0.37 was also the one that required samples for a lot of the Nintendo games like Donkey Kong, Galaga needed samples. Bosconia needed a blow-up sample. After that, a lot of people have never gotten to play MAME that far back. Most people started off with a later build of MAME where you didn't need samples for everything, and you did have access to a lot bigger, richer set of ROMs. So when you're looking at evaluating what MAME can I play on here, just understand this isn't the latest and greatest MAME that you can get on the PC. It is the last of the, I don't know what you even call it, the simple builds of MAME before they got carried away. And as such, you will suffer from some of the issues that generation of MAME had, namely the PROM support, which monkeys up colors in GORF, for example. Wizard of War has some monkeyed up colors in it. Star Trek Strategic Operations Simulator has weird sound samples. You'll have to have samples for all the sound in Donkey Kong. Those are the sort of things that this particular build, and this is not just an Android build. The if and when you can ever get a hold of it on iOS, they've used the exact same ROM core that this does, along with GP2X, PSP. All the builds of MAME for all are built around the same version of MAME. So you're not missing anything going to this versus, say, your PSP. So if you've got a full set of ROMs on your PSP that you were playing, chances are likely to be able to move some, if not all of them, over directly to MAME for all on Android. So that's a really a nice thing to have access to. What about like Neo Geo? That's another one that I get asked a lot about on Android devices, because Neo Geo was another one where if you really wanted to see just how good your machine was, you tried to run these big fat Neo Geo games. Did you have any chances to run Neo Geo stuff on there?
I did. I ran some of the Metal Slug games.
Yeah.
And they ran great.
That's amazing.
I played, I think it was Metal Slug 1 or 2. I played for a bit and ran just fine.
That's fantastic.
You know, I think I just crashed it trying to load an arc, so that's not a good thing.
That's some good stuff. Okay, so pretty much anything outside of the Amiga or control restrictive type emulation, you'd say this is a good product then?
Yeah, you gotta ask yourself what exactly are you planning on doing with this thing? And like I said, I'll in terms of anyone trying to use this as their first Android device, you'd be doing yourself a huge disservice. I would say, you know, I treat this thing as, remember those old chemistry sets you'd get, you know, back in the old days?
I do.
You gotta go into it expecting that it could blow up in your face, and you gotta, you know, be able to deal with that. I know when I got my first Android phone, I was very jittery about tinkering with it. But when you're talking about a $140 device, you know, you're without a 2-year contract, you're probably gonna feel a little bit better if things go awry. And you can reset this thing. Something I should mention. I went through all of that process of rooting and removing all of the Chinese software and all of the there was just tons of just oddball stuff in their chat clients and the weirdest stuff that you just couldn't tell what it was because it was in Chinese writing. But I ended up doing something weird and screwing the machine up, and I had to reset the factory default. And when I did, guess what? I got this nice stock ROM without any of that stuff on there. So I probably could have taken that shortcut. Now, I mentioned it to a couple of guys in some forums who had the device also, and some people are saying they can do that. Other people are saying they can't do that. We think it's that if you have the capacitive version and you factory default reset, all the Chinese stuff comes back. Mm. But if you've got the resistive one, you can save yourself a lot of time. The only thing that comes back is that really odd loader. That if you've seen pictures of this thing online, you'll see this loader that's got like, I mean, these guys are shameless. They call it Game Center, and it's got all of you know, Angry Birds and Plants vs. Zombies and all that stuff. That loader comes back, but you know, you just grab any loader of your choice and activate it, and that kind of hides in the background.
So sweet. Okay, so let's wrap this guy up. So let's say there's a lot of people in the retro gaming community. We're used to tinkering. We're used to fooling around, rebuilding main sets, or, you know, there's a lot of people listening to the show that are comfortable with monkeying around with stuff. And it sounds like there's pretty much an exit strategy. No matter what you do, you could probably get that device back to ground zero if you tinker and you mess something up. So let's give it a rating out of the box, no tinkering. What would you give it out of, say, 10? Out of the box, no monkeying, no rooting.
You know, I would give it probably a 7.
A 7, that's a better score than I thought you were going to give it.
Really, I would like to give it more. The shoulder buttons to me are almost unforgivable just because of, I mean, I can almost forgive the Bluetooth thing because they're giving you the physical controls that you're asking for, but shoulder buttons are a huge problem for me. The other thing is that part of the advantage of what I really enjoyed about, setting this thing up, as opposed to setting up the canoe, which was with the canoe, you got to pull the SD card out and, you know, do it the old fashioned way, drop and drag files. You know, I loved using Dropbox with this thing and just moving my stuff over the network with Wi-Fi and emailing stuff to myself. So when it worked, it was beautiful. You could, you know, you'd realize, I'm missing, a particular ROM, or I'm missing a particular file. Let me send it to myself. And that was fantastic. I would say about 30 to 40% of the time, something weird would happen. And when I say something weird, like I go back to as an Android device, it can be pretty frustrating. The Wi-Fi, on it, is very temperamental. So sometimes it'll just hang and not work. And everything's resolved with a reboot, but the reboot process, you know, takes a good minute and a half, so it's not a fast reboot. In terms of if you're going to load a ton of emulators on there, if you're going to fill a 32 gigabyte card with games and pop it in there and just turn it on, load an emulator and start playing. Yeah, you know, you're going to get great Atari, you're going to get great Commodore 64, you're going to get great, fantastic MAME, and some of those other Nintendo and Sega systems that I mentioned. TurboGrafx runs great on it as well. But if you're planning on doing anything else, you're going to get frustrated. And the setup process is time-consuming, especially if you want to do anything customized like. And you're going to need that Wi-Fi connectivity. You're going to need to load the Google Market or the Android Market. And you're going to need to load your Gmail. As an Android device, it chokes on the simplest things. It chokes on Google Plus, so you can't use Google Plus with it.
Oh, great.
It doesn't run GTalk. So it's the weirdest stuff. And then, the way that the capacitive versus resistive situation, I guess that's more of a knock on the retailer I bought it from, the online retailer. But yeah, that left a bad taste in my mouth too. You know, I was kind of expecting one thing and I got another. But 7, high 6 to 7.
And you're saying you'd give it a 7 if you didn't tinker with it at all. You open the box, you put it in somebody's hand and say, this is what you get. No rooting, nothing. You'd give it 7 for that.
No, much lower.
Okay, that's what I was looking for. Give it that low number.
Yeah.
Let's say that somebody, Joe Q Public doesn't know how to root, doesn't even know anything about Android. He wants something to play, you know, retro games on. He's going to order it, he's going to open the box, and he's going to use it as is. What's the score?
Probably a 2 or 3. First of all, the emphasis on what comes preloaded on it is on modern stuff. I would say a good, even though they call it, like, they list it as a retro gaming Android tablet, it's just most of what you find on there is Plants vs. Zombies and Asphalt and Angry Birds and Cut the Rope and all that stuff. And those games are all gimped out because you're dealing with a resistant screen. I'd say it's pretty bad. The stuff that you do get, because it does come loaded with ROMs, particularly for Game Boy Advance, a lot of MAME stuff. The MAME is almost like it's a ton of Japanese fighting games. You know, like, it doesn't come with, like, this Pac-Man or Donkey Kong or Robotron. It's you know, Street Fighter and a bunch of stuff I didn't recognize, that was, the Japanese fighting game genre. And so you really have to tinker with it. You really, you know, have to roll up your sleeves and read up but the good thing, like you were saying, is that it's really easy to go back to square one. All you need is a paper clip and hold a button down for 30 seconds and you're back to square one. And I've done that now, I guess, 3 times. Because as you start to disable Chinese stuff and you know, trying to clear it of any garbage you might not need, and you know, you could accidentally nuke something that's important. And I'm sure I screwed up the camera at some point, and it's just not important enough to me to fix it. But yeah, it does take some trial and error.
So this is definitely a tinker's device. You would say there's not much value unless you plan on getting your hand, rolling up the sleeves, getting your hands a little bit dirty. But, and if you're willing to do that, then you'd give the device a fairly solid 7, you'd think.
Yeah, absolutely. And you know what? Since I got it working the way I want it to work, I don't play games on my Transformer anymore. That's a big deal. And my Canoe's collecting dust as well. So it's taken its place as my main machine. That's what I play Atari on. It's what I play, you know, pretty much all my emulation stuff on. So it does the job. It's a shame about the shoulder buttons, but I almost think it's not the kind of, you know, it's almost disposable. Like I think it's probably more likely that I'll buy another $150 Chinese device with gingerbread on it than if this one will actually get gingerbread. So that's why, you know, at $100, $150, I don't know about that $180 capacitive one. If it came with gingerbread, I'd say maybe. And if they could guarantee you'd have the Bluetooth, but missing the shoulder buttons, $180, I'd pass on that.
Well, this is awesome. I mean, at least there, it would appear, and you said this before, that those Chinese sites will just knock off anything, that there could be another solution kicking around out there, similar in nature, that might solve a lot of these problems.
Yeah, there is a, another, device similar to this, the Yinlips. I think they've got a new one that's, it's got an ARM, A10 Cortex processor that's supposed to be pretty beefy, but one of our buddies, Rob D, on Google Plus, he's a Maximum RD. He has a lot of, he's pretty active in the retro community, and he's got a YouTube channel. If you look up Maximum RD, you'll find him. But he's got one of these Yinlips devices. It looks like he, I don't know if he dropped it or something, but he cracked the screen on it. So I mean to watch that video and find out whatever happened to his Yinlips machine. But yeah, that seems to be the other, if there's a DS versus PSP in the Chinese knockoffs, it's the Yinlips versus the JXD S7100. But those are the two flavors, and I've heard good things about the Yinlips one too. I don't have any first-hand experience.
It's amazing what's going on over there. It truly is.
Yeah. But you know, at those kind of cheap prices, and hopefully they stay cheap.
Yeah.
Because getting up into the 160, 180 is getting kind of hovering out of cheap. But you know, at 100, 120, 140, I wouldn't mind buying one of these, you know, every once in a while as the tech advances, and just as my kind of Android emulation erector set, and just kind of poke around and do things I'm too afraid to do with my expensive tablet or expensive phone.
Right. Some crazy stuff. Well, Alex, thanks for taking the opportunity and sitting down with us and putting that little sucker through the test. I know a lot of people are interested in these newer devices, these Android-powered devices, and I think Android's really making this all possible. I think that this this open source nature, just letting everybody do whatever the hell they want with it, seems to be working out.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, there's really been kind of a resurgence in emulation due to the newness and the hotness of smartphones and tablets and everything. So it's nice to see emulation get that kind of attention.
It's very nice. Well, thanks again, Alex. The product we've been looking at today is the JXD S7100 Android Retro Game Console, and that's at iShareGifts.com is where Alex picked his up. And out of the box, so you're going to get, out of a scale from 1 to 10, Alex gives this a 2, maybe a 3, because it really does require a lot of tinkering. But once you're willing to play with it, nice solid 7, huh?
Yeah. It's a fun little toy to mess around with. And, you know, for any of you out there that may pick one of these up and need some tips or any advice on how to kind of get around a lot of the pre-installed stuff or customizing it, hit us up on Google Plus. I mean, we're always on there discussing this and a number of other things related to devices and retro gaming, of course. But you can find me and Shane on Google Plus, as well as the Retro Gaming Radio page on Google Plus. That's probably the easiest way to find us, or hit the Monroe World forums. And I believe we've already got a thread started on the device, and I probably need to add a bunch of info to that. But if you have any questions, just look us up.
All right. Well, thanks again, Alex. We're going to wrap up this review and finish up the show. Again, thanks for stopping in with us, Alex.
Hey, thanks.
Well, folks, that's going to wrap it up for this episode of Retro Gaming Radio. Big thanks to Cloanto, makers of Commodore 64 Forever and Amiga Forever, for donating the prizes for our iHeart C64 contest. Congratulations to the winners again. And let's see, what else do I need to tell you about? Oh, don't forget to check out RGR Plus TV. Go to RetroGamingRadio.com. Click on the RGR Plus TV link and experience the show like you've never experienced it before. For those of you who'd like to listen to older shows, join our Shoutcast server. Go to Shoutcast.com, type in Retro Gaming Radio, and you will be able to listen 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, to almost 10 years of classic Retro Gaming Radio shows. Alex J. Lopez puts that on and does a great playlist for us, so big thanks to him for running that. And once again, thanks for all the new listeners and old listeners who have rejoined the show. We're thrilled to have you guys back. And I guess that's going to do it. This is Shane R. Monroe with Retro Gaming Radio saying until next time, keep it retro.